You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Julianne Tweeten, discussing how the fake news scare is marginalizing the left. That is the title of an article in These Times by our guest. Julianne Tweeten writes about the technology industry's relationship with socioeconomics and culture. In addition to In These Times, her work has appeared in The Baffler, Current Affairs, The Outline, Rewire News, Truthout, and elsewhere. And she is the irregular tech correspondent on This Is Hell Radio. Julianne Tweeten, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing this article. So how is the left being marginalized?
That's a good question. So the article I wrote about is kind of a confluence of various issues, leading with the fake news narrative. The idea is that fake news is essentially, it's not really a defined concept, but various corporate media outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN are furthering this narrative. And in doing so, they're kind of implying that fake news is far left and far right media, and that the only media that can really be trusted is corporate media and traditionally centrist media. And this is extended to Google, Facebook, and Twitter, which, as I'm sure all listeners know, are instrumental in disseminating media to internet users. And those sites have also kind of adopted these principles of furthering more centrist media while tending to censor and kind of stifle left-leaning dissent. So that's kind of the underlying principle of what's going on here.
It's interesting to define fake news as news that is far left or far right, because in your article you talk about, you know, Google sort of suggesting that they can determine what is real news and censor the fake news. And I'm wondering, well, if fake news is false news, how in the world does some guy at Google know what's true and what isn't? But if the good news is just the politically centrist news, well, then that's easy. Google can hire a bunch of people to identify it. Is that what they're proposing to do?
Exactly. They're certainly, I think, on board with having the power to determine what is fake news and what is not. And it seems as though the government has been complicit in allowing Google and other companies to have that kind of control. So Google has been, obviously, is a search monopoly and has had control over which sites tend to appear higher in search results. And in the process, since Google has updated its algorithms in the wake of the fake news scare and being placed in the center of the argument of who is exposed to fake news, Google has updated its algorithms, and in the process, various particularly left-wing sites have seen their search traffic plummet. So that means the World Socialist website, that's the news outlet that has been kind of the most vociferous about this. It has claimed that it's seen its traffic dip by 67%, and it's named several other sites that have seen their traffic plummet as well. Alternet, Democracy Now!, et cetera. Google also, I think, would like to take this further. Its chairman, or rather its parent company's chairman, Eric Schmidt, has talked about computers being able to detect fake news using artificial intelligence. And he has said that, it should be possible for computers to detect misinformation. And he said, we're not arguing for censorship, we're arguing just to take it off the page. So it seems like Google's idea here is to preemptively censor, and obviously its censorship policies would be a matter of its own discretion. And Google is a company that, again, as I'm sure your listeners know, is predominantly white and male, is predominantly composed of pretty affluent people, and is a giant corporation that is motivated by profit. In Google's understanding, Google's vision of its own ability to control fake news is potentially disastrous and does not bode well.
But if fake news is being defined as too far left or too far right, why is it only too far left websites that are seeing this incredible drop in traffic being directed to them by the Google search engine?
That's a great question. So I think that far left sites tend to bear more of a brunt in this sense, because when you examine the politics of tech companies, it's a fairly kind of complicated issue. So many tech companies have been participating with, contracting with intelligence agencies, and many tech companies have been partnered with the Democratic Party, and they've donated to the Democratic Party for quite a long time. But also, we've seen that a lot of the tech industry is kind of enables more far-right ideologies, like the Google Manifesto written by James Damore fairly recently that was talking about that was lambasting diversity initiatives and suggesting that Google is a meritocracy, and America is a meritocracy, and that affirmative action shouldn't happen. So there is a bit of a slippery slope, I think, with the kind of centrist-friendly nature of tech companies into a more far-right ideology. But I think one thing that the tech industry is not interested in is anti-corporate, anti-capitalist sentiment. And I think the same thing tends to apply with the government, particularly the kind of corporate-friendly Democratic Party. There is still less of an inclination to really feature far-right news on social media and on Google, but there hasn't been nearly the extent of reporting and of claims that there has been for the right, that there has been for the left. So I think there's an especially hostile climate towards radical politics, towards left-leaning anti-capitalist politics, I think, because those pose the greatest threat to the status quo and to tech companies and to corporate-friendly government.
Well, if Google has problems, surely Facebook can save us. What is Julianne Tweeten? What is Facebook's record here, and what is the deal with the claims that a tiny number of possibly Russian ads unrelated to the election determined the election?
So the current narrative is that Facebook hosted $100,000 worth of ads that were allegedly created by Russian actors and were meant to sow discord. So they, various sites like CNN and New York Times and Washington Post have suggested that the ads were designed to bolster support for Jill Stein and Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump instead of Hillary Clinton, and to appeal to gun owners and to appeal to anti-immigrant sentiment. I think the most offensive of all is the suggestion that Russian actors were manipulating people into protesting racism. So the Facebook narrative is deeply misguided. It kind of overestimates, I think, the effects of $100,000 worth of ads. Facebook is a multi-billion-dollar company, and the election was a $6.8 billion election. It's a bit of a baseless exaggeration. crazy.
And if the Russians are behind both Black Lives Matter and the fascists who come to my town here in Charlottesville, who does that? I mean, forget the actual evidence for the claim. But if those were both Russian projects, who does that help elect, and what is the point of it?
That's what I've been wondering, because the language that has been used around the Russian narrative has been very vague, and in this particular instance, a lot of the narrative is that Russian agents were planning to sow discord. That's as far as it goes. They were planning to plant chaos in the United States. They were planning to divide voters. And you're exactly right. And I've been wondering the same thing. Who does that? What does that really accomplish ultimately? If the narrative is that Russia was hoping to get Trump elected, why weren't all of the ads right wing? Why weren't they all pro Trump? So I think this dichotomy of far right and far left Russian ads doesn't make very much sense. And the idea that they were planning to sow discord, okay, maybe, but again, what does that lead to? What is the end goal for them? I have, I think, just as many questions about it as you do.
And it just seems to me that opposing the murdering of Black people is a pro-democratic, small d, democratic activity, just as finding out what one of your political parties is up to via WikiLeaks strengthens democracy rather than weakens it. I'd like to find out who did that and thank them, but I haven't seen any evidence that it was the Russian government. In these new claims, is there any actual evidence that the Russian government is behind any of this?
There isn't that I've seen. And like I said, a lot of the language that's been used around the Russian narrative, including these recent stories about Facebook and Twitter, is very nebulous. It's a lot of words like likely and suspected and believed to be and apparent. Only one news outlet, I think, published any screenshots of the ads themselves. There was one New York Times article that published screenshots of the ads themselves, but otherwise the evidence has been non-existent. It's been pretty strictly speculation, and I think that's very much a testament to the fact that the Russian narrative and the fake news narrative are just kind of desperate attempts to reconcile and to come to grips with the fact that Donald Trump was elected and that someone like that could be elected in the United States. No real evidence that I've seen, just more speculation, just more kind of clamoring for some sort of explanation or some sort of PR friendly explanation for why this could have happened.
It seems like if just this latest story had come out by itself after several months of silence, very few people would take it seriously. But I think a lot of people see it as icing on a cake because there have been so many. I mean, this story, as you note in your article, sort of builds on the website that the Washington Post promoted months ago that gave a long list of many of them left-wing media outlets and accused them of being, Russian operatives on the basis of absolutely no evidence, including several outlets that I've written articles for and have yet to get a dime from Russia. How do these stories keep coming out when that one, was debunked months ago?
So I guess there's an interesting distinction between the proper not issue and the current one, because I think proper not was maybe a little too forthright. And proper not approached many media outlets and was dismissed by them because I think it looked a little too paranoid. But there's been...
But that suited the Washington Post just fine.
Yes. But there has been, I guess, kind of a more artful approach when the stories are kind of incremental. When these stories are incremental, it's easier to present it as, or to make people think that it's evidence. When you say Facebook had $100,000 worth of political ads, and Twitter had 200 suspected accounts. I think there is, again, like I said, there's a lot of vague, non-committal language being used in these news stories, but also I think there's a combination of that with what's intended to be concrete evidence, you know, numbers and statistics. And even though the ads and the accounts in question have not been confirmed to be linked to Russia, I think there's still an attempt to make it seem objective and to make it seem like it's very real. So, if that answers your question.
It does, yeah. So we have, you know, Google redirecting people, you know, not to more accurate news, but to more corporate news. Facebook, you note in your article, has something of a racist bias in terms of who it opposes and who it favors. And how is Twitter doing in terms of who it blocks and who it doesn't block?
Twitter and Facebook in particular have some very serious issues with racist policy, which, I mean, I think unequivocally reflects the fact that these companies are run by rich white men. So Facebook has had very serious issues with stifling the voices of particularly black activists. While protecting white men. There was a big ProPublica report about that. Twitter has had similar issues. There have been many anecdotal accounts about how Twitter will kind of elevate the voices of Nazis, for example, while punishing the voices of people who are more likely to dissent, like Richard Spencer, for example, the face of the neo-Nazi quote alt-right movement, is verified on Twitter. So he's been given this platform that makes him look legitimate and makes him look like a real cultural and political figure with authority and gravitas. The Outline published a report about this as well in greater detail about Twitter's Nazi problem. So I mentioned Facebook earlier. I think it's worth noting that Facebook has previously had ad settings for advertisers who want to advertise on Facebook, where advertisers could choose which races they advertise to. And this was for employment ads, and this was for housing ads. And so Facebook was clearly breaking the law, violating the Fair Housing Act, Fair Employment. And so both Facebook and Twitter have had have these very, very clearly, manifestly racist policies. And I think you know, the government has paid very little attention to this. There's been previously a really laissez-faire approach with allowing these companies to handle these violations on their own.
Yeah.
And really only now, I know the Black Congressional Caucus has drawn attention to the racism inherent in Facebook's platform, but really, the government has not stepped in and intervened and really made an effort to regulate until the Russia scandal arose. So there's a lot of hypocrisy going on here as well.
It's funny, the local NBC station here in Charlottesville has a Richard Spencer problem as well, which has resulted in a boycott. But how do you boycott Facebook? They've got a better monopoly than NBC. You know, they've got a lock on this audience. And these companies, Facebook, Twitter, Google, are cozying up to the government and to the so-called intelligence agencies, and that seems to be treated as acceptable, leading toward real news rather than fake news. So what does that suggest about our concept of what news is supposed to be?
Yeah, well, look at who's in government right now. Things are pretty dire and obviously are very, very skewed towards white supremacy. And Facebook and Twitter and Google and other companies like Amazon are, you know, as anti-regulatory as they are, they still have kind of colluded with various intelligence agencies, and that might continue to happen. Information that we see is being controlled by both intelligence agencies and these tech companies, again, as I said, that are controlled by affluent white men who have, again, very, very dangerous politics. If you look at people like James Damore, the author of the Google Manifesto, Peter Thiel, who was potentially going to be on Trump's cabinet, et cetera. The issue of Facebook and Google and Twitter kind of having monopolies over the way that people consume media is a very dire prospect and something that that really needs to be questioned and overhauled.
It seems like this idea of fake news, it's a new, you know, phrase, but it's not a new concept to bash the media, even for presidents. I don't know if, you know, if Trump outdoes Richard Nixon in bashing the media and earlier eras as well. But what seems new is the popularity of it, the public support for bashing the media. I mean, am I right about that? And is that a result of the work of the networks and the newspapers, or of the social media, or what's causing this?
Yeah, I think you're right in saying that this is not a new phenomenon, but I think it maybe feels new because of the new digital platforms that are involved in disseminating media. Because obviously, having social media and having search engines is a modern phenomenon that's really only become commonplace in the 21st century. I think the term fake news as we understand it originated several years ago, before the election, when Facebook was accused of having suppressed right-wing news sites in its news aggregator. Again, it's not a new concept. Like you mentioned, we saw it in Nixon's paranoia about the press. There's always going to be, as long as there is a free press, there's always going to be tension with the people in power who are concerned about the way they're depicted and will spin narratives any way they see fit. I think any reason that it feels new would be just that there are these new platforms that are disseminating it, and the internet has kind of transitioned us all into a much more consistent pattern of media consumption.
And yet I seem to increasingly get questions at public events from people raising their hands saying, well, where should I find reliable news? How, when the
right.
internet is saying everything and its opposite, what am I supposed to do? I'd be curious what advice you would give people on that.
That is a great question. And it's a difficult one to answer because, as I say in my article, we don't really have a definition of what fake news is. I given my politics, I prefer to read left-wing news. And I just think it's because I think those are the only ones that are kind of seeing through White House and corporate PR. It is, you know, it's a bit of an exercise in media literacy, and it's a testament to the fact that our monopolies of media dissemination are very pro-capitalist and benefit from capitalism, and are basically transitioning into monopolies, and that is something that needs to be overturned. But in the process, it's very important to foster media literacy and to try to understand that we shouldn't always trust what sites like the Washington Post and the New York Times tell us, because a lot of the time it's just White House PR or the PR of the billionaires who own them. Again, yeah, it's not an easy process, but media literacy is very important. I think just the starting point is just to be leery of and to remember that tech companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter are designed by people. They're not objective. They have agendas, and we should be wary of them.
Yeah, and perhaps wary of any robotic, computerized sensor of fake news as well.
Absolutely, because it's still designed by people, usually very, very privileged people with their own politics.
Indeed. When you say you look to leftist sources of news, and feel free to name some of them, I assume you don't mean what some people think of as the left in the United States, and that is Democratic Party loyal sources of news.
Yes. That's right. I think the most reliable news out there, I think, is non-corporate, because there are no advertisers to be beholden to. Generally, media that is not corporate sponsored tends to be more reliable, in my experience. And again, that's the type of media that can afford to be adversarial and can afford to be more investigative. And, you know, the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, who also owns Amazon and owns Blue Origin, which is a space exploration company.
And Amazon owns big CIA contracts.
Yes, a $600 million CIA contract, I believe. The Atlantic was recently acquired by Lorraine Powell Jobs, who was married to Steve Jobs. So a lot of these mainstream media sites are owned by billionaires who have, again, very specific political agendas. They have projects that they need good PR on. And so, again, in this climate, I think the most trustworthy sources are the ones that are not advertiser, that are not corporate owned, and that are not beholden to advertisers and sponsors.
With just a minute left, Julianne Tweeten, do you think it seems to me that the Democrats largely have pushed this Russiagate madness so far that any connection to anything Russian is a sin, and suddenly people seem to be caring about what governments put money into the Clinton Family Foundation, where, you know, Saudi Arabia and many others were fine, but what about Russia? Is this thing going to backfire on its creators?
gosh, it just might. It's tough to say, but I can't see this ending in a constructive way for the Democrats. I will say that. There's a recent bill that's been circulating that is supposed to regulate political ads on the internet, and I think one of the stipulations is being more vigilant with ads from foreign governments. And so there is, I think, you know, this is ballooning into just paranoid xenophobia, and I don't think this can end well or in any sort of constructive way for its propagators.
I am with you. That and the lack of evidence are a couple of big flaws. Julianne Tweeten's article is called How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left, and it's at In These Times. Julianne, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, thanks mainly to independent and social media, and of course activism like Black Lives Matter, Americans have been forced to confront and to know more about police brutality and racism in the criminal justice system than just a few years ago. But corporate media conversation about what to do with that knowledge is constrained. We may hear editorial calls for better training or more data, or sometimes even convictions of individual officers. But somehow we never see the problem of policing whole. So the deeper reckoning necessary for real change is forestalled. A new book hopes to forward that conversation. It's called The End of Policing. Author Alex Vitale is sociology professor and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. We'll talk with him about his new book. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Counterspin talked last week about how cities across the country are vying to be home to Amazon's second headquarters and a promised 50,000 jobs. Corporate media seem keenest on approaching it as a sort of beauty pageant or game show. But as what's being offered are public goods in terms of tax subsidies, citizens seem due minimally some honest reckoning of whether the cost is worth it. And maybe even some challenge to the idea that cities and states gifting billions to wildly profitable corporations is really the best we can do. Along those lines, twice in two articles, D.C.-based Washington Post reporter Jonathan O'Connell referred to massive dollar amounts in terms of how much Amazon might bring to local economies. In Seattle, an October 19th piece stated, quote, Amazon has contributed $30 billion to the local economy and as much as $55 billion more in spin-off benefits, close quote. On October 23rd, he reported, quote, to accommodate the company's growth in Seattle, taxpayers funded hundreds of millions of dollars in improvements, although Amazon directly contributed $30 billion to the local economy, close quote. For FAIR analyst Adam Johnson, the fact that neither reference had a link or a citation was a red flag. It turns out those figures could be derived by adding up numbers in an Amazon press release O'Connell had linked to as a source for a separate claim about which cities were submitting bids. When asked via Twitter where he got the figures, O'Connell linked to a different Amazon press release with the same totals. But he added something about talking to econ folks. Asked which econ folks, O'Connell didn't respond. The Amazon press release provided no source or methodology or meaningful third-party confirmation. Copy and pasting a corporation's claims for its own economic impact, when it has every incentive to hype those numbers, is sloppy enough. But doing so for a corporation whose CEO is also your CEO, listeners know Amazon chief Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, well, that's a pretty stark conflict. Other outlets who cited the figures, such as the AP and Business Insider, did note that they were simply assertions by Amazon. Of course, an independent source would be better, but at least they provided attribution and a notice to readers to take the claims with a grain of salt. The Post simply presented them as fact. When Bezos bought the Post in 2013 for $250 million, there was a lot of speculation about his motives. We can't really know those, but as Johnson observes, having a major paper do your boosting, just as you're on a mission to squeeze as much out of a host city as possible, does make the paper seem less like a billionaire's toy and more like a shrewd PR investment. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The litany of instances of police violence and misconduct is both infuriating and almost numbing. Our guest's new book suggests we reconsider our understanding of policing, see it less as a tool that has on some occasions been used for abuse, and more as a tool for abuse, a system that does considerable harm even when functioning as designed. That reflects more closely the history of the institution in this country, and it's really only seeing things that radically, going to the root, that lets us see a way out. Not a way back to some imagined time in which there was harmony between police and community everywhere, but forward to a time in which policies of punishment don't distort so many societal functions and consign huge numbers of especially black and brown people to the margins. The book is called The End of Policing. Author Alex Vitale is professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Alex Vitale.
Thank you.
Well, people are offended, I think, morally when you suggest that the inequity of the impact of policing is not a bug, but a feature. I think we tend to think of it as an institution made in a lab. You know, we need protection from criminals, so let's create law enforcement. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit of the actual history of U.S. policing that shapes the role that we see it playing today.
Sure. Well, there's kind of a standard liberal narrative, academic narrative, historical narrative about the police that begins with the London Metropolitan Police formed in 1829. And the idea behind it that's propagated behind it is that it was an improvement over the kind of semi-professional watch that was made up of volunteers and others pressed into service that would walk around at night. On the one hand, and a kind of the use of the militia to put down riots and disorder on the other hand. And the feeling was that this would be a civilian force under the control of local authorities and would engage in a kind of neutral enforcement of the law. But the reality is that the model for the London Metropolitan Police actually is directly tied to the British occupation of Ireland. And the person who creates the London Police, Robert Peel, Robert Bob, the Bobbies, had been in charge of the British occupation of Ireland, and it was there that he begins to develop the idea of a civilian force that could be used to put down rural uprisings more efficiently than relying on the British Army, which had been tied up in the Napoleonic Wars, was overstretched and highly indebted. So he creates the Irish Peace Preservation Force, which is located in local communities, which allows for better surveillance and preemptive action to put down social unrest. London during this period is awash in this newly industrializing working class that's come from rural areas. And the job of the police was to both micromanage the lives of this new industrial urban workforce in a way that tried to mold them into a reliable workforce. So there were all kinds of little minor nuisance laws that were enforced, as well as prescriptions on, you know, drunken disorderly behavior, et cetera, that had the purpose of getting people to go home to their families, get up in the work in the morning and go to work and be productive, and to try to stamp out lifestyles that weren't tied to a standard industrial work life. At the same time, they put down riots, they put down labor movements, they attack strikers, etc. And we can see this in the U.S. context as well, with the creation of forces to drive Native American populations out, to drive out Mexicans from what was becoming Texas at the time to stamp out workers' movements, to shoot miners in Pennsylvania, et cetera. And so the book basically argues that the origins of policing should be understood as intimately tied to three major forms of accumulation during the 19th century, and these are slavery, colonialism, and the new industrial workforce.
So it's always been a kind of social engineering, if you will. The definition of crime itself has been very much shaped by the sort of social control impetus of the enterprise of policing.
It was a new way of constructing state power that was more fine-tuned than relying on the army and the militia. It was able to produce legitimacy for the state in a way that the army was not. It relied on brute power. And so this was much more efficient for the state, and the state immediately began on this kind of myth-making of saying that, well, of course, we understand the state is legitimate because these are liberal democracies of some form, and therefore any expression of state power is legitimate. But all of that discourse completely hides slavery, completely hides the suppression of workers' movements. And so the actual tasks of this seemingly legitimate state are in fact designed to reproduce race and class inequalities. And the police are just a softer touch in carrying out that mission.
Well, you can certainly see a worldview at work that is fomented, I think, by media, in which you want police to have all of the weapons and you want them to have freedom to do anything at all, because there are good and bad people in the world and cops protect the good from the bad. You know, when major percentages of people are going to prison for nonviolent drug offenses, for example, this idea that there are different sorts of people, bad criminals who do harm and good non-criminals, you have to challenge that.
Well, this is the problem with all this thin blue line and kind of war on cops discourse that's out there, is that it assumes that the world is divided up between good people and bad people, and that the only way to produce safety, to protect the good from the bad, is through coercive state power, the threat of arrest, the use of violence. And of course, when we look at middle class, leafy, suburban communities, they don't need police to manage their social problems. They have mechanisms and resources to regulate those things themselves. And of course, they're beneficiaries in large part from the basic political and economic arrangements. And so no one feels like, oh, well, of course, they need heavy-handed policing in those communities. It's poor people who are perceived to be only responsive to this kind of coercive power.
Well, the book, and I do want to get on to it, because the book talks about alternatives. It talks about a way that we could do things differently. So I wanted to get you started talking about that. When we're talking about this kind of, you know, you say at one point whole segments of our society have been deemed always already guilty. And it's there that the most help is needed, of course. So what are some of the alternatives to policing that the book is getting at?
Well, what I do is I take eight areas of policing and look at the origins of that kind of policing, what the problem is it claims to be trying to solve, and then look at the literature that shows just how many problems that kind of policing actually produces rather than resolves. And then try to lay out a series of alternatives to relying on police. So we don't need nicer school police. We don't need better trained school police. The whole idea of school policing is deeply flawed. All the research shows that it doesn't make young people any safer. It contributes to an environment of insecurity for young people. It's also often demeaning, degrading, abusive, and at times even deadly to these young people. There are alternatives to relying on police to deal with discipline issues in schools. And there are schools that are using these methods, like restorative justice programs, where the whole school is oriented not towards driving people out of school and into the criminal justice system, but in trying to actually resolve problems. And they use various forms of peer mediation, peer adjudication. We could look at a community schools model that's being tried out in some areas where the school is seen as a resource center for the whole community so that after hours on the weekends, there are classes and services available to the families of students so that if there is a mental health issue, if there is an English as a second language problem that maybe is contributing to financial insecurity, if there are nutrition issues, health issues, the school could be seen as a resource for that rather than just another place where young people are criminalized.
And I would say the book also talks about, you know, police dealing with people with mental illness. It talks about the war on drugs and border policing and political policing, as you say, a number of different aspects in which the police seem to be taking on roles that would be better played by other social forces and other social mechanisms. Of course, what people will hear and should hear is that this requires resources. This requires a redirection of resources. And I think I imagine that would be some of the pushback, is simply this myth of scarcity that we hear, that we just can't invest in communities somehow.
So a lot of the money we're spending now on the criminal justice system is not making people safer. It's often making communities less safe because of the disruptive effects of cycling people through prisons and jails. And we could redirect a lot of those resources. The Youth Justice Coalition out in Los Angeles wrote a report a couple of years ago where they said, let's look at the spending in LA County on police, jails, courts, and if we redirected just 10% of that money, we'd have $1 billion a year to spend on new youth programs. And they worked with young people to lay out a program of what kinds of services would actually help young people. And they had summer jobs and after-school programs and more counselors in the schools and these kinds of things, rather than more school police, more gang suppression policing, more gang injunctions, the kinds of things that the county spends a lot of money on that don't work.
Well, you do cite a lot of existing work that this is building on. So there is a history of consideration of this idea. And then, as you're saying, places where it's actually being tried, or some aspects of it are being tried.
Every chapter is filled with examples of alternatives that lay out a program that says there are non-coercive solutions to our problems, and the thing that's preventing us from doing them is not an absence of money, it's an excess of neoliberal, neoconservative, austerity politics that has labeled the poor as incapable of benefiting from any kind of positive, proactive interventions, and defines them as basically only capable of responding to threats and punishment. And in a way, this is, I think, a kind of profoundly racist ideology. Even though it is embraced by many Black and Latino politicians, it really treats their constituencies as less than fully human, and then subjects them to dehumanizing treatment by the police, jails, prisons, etc. And so we can't just tinker with the police response to make it a little bit nicer or to make the police department a little more diverse, because none of that gets at this core problem. We have to really directly address the politics of the country that's largely bipartisan, that says that, you know, the only way we can solve problems is to criminalize them, whether it's homelessness, severe mental illness, discipline problems in schools, youth violence, etc. We've got to break this mindset that policing is the only tool that people can have.
Well, you say, I've heard you say at some point, I think of abolition as a process rather than an outcome. What are you getting at with that? And is the book, I assume the book is an attempt to sort of spark that process?
Yeah, I never start from the position of, like, imagine a world without police, something like that. I don't think that's very helpful. I think it's alienating to most people. It's confusing, and it doesn't seem, you know, realistic. However, underneath that is the root idea that policing as an institution should be understood as deeply problematic, historically, functionally, and contemporarily, and that it should always be approached as the tool of last resort, so that if a community has a problem, and many of our communities do have serious problems, wouldn't it be better to start from the position of saying, let's put all the resources of the community, of government at different levels, on the table, nonprofits, and say, how can we best solve this problem? And we could have some principles in that process, that what we do should be cost effective. There should actually be evidence to show that it can work. And it should try to treat people with as much dignity as possible. And when we have a process like that, such as when Ithaca looked at their opioid problem and developed a plan for opioids that didn't involve criminalization, it involved drug treatment on demand and safe injection facilities and needle exchange, et cetera. When we do that, we can come up with non-coercive solutions for so many problems that we've asked the police today to deal with. And so that's the process that should guide community-based problem solving, which is the exact opposite of what most communities experience today, which is government tells them that they have to express the problem in terms that can be solved by the use of more police power, more police resources. And unfortunately, things like community policing are part of that problematic dynamic, where all community problems have to be articulated in terms of what the police can do to solve them, rather than holding the rest of government accountable for not doing something about these problems.
Well, I just attended the Drug Policy Reform Conference in Atlanta, and one of the things that was said was that, you know, in a way, criminal justice reform is trending now, but we have to be very wary about what it means, you know, because at this point, anything that you do that decreases the prison population can be seen as reform, you know, but people can still be ensnared in the criminal justice system. And one of the things that I think Deborah Small from Breaking the Chain said was, you don't have to lock people up to lock them out. So there is reason to be cautious about what is going to be put forward right now. There seems to be a bipartisan understanding that, oh, yes, mass incarceration is bad. We should get those numbers down. That doesn't necessarily mean they are going to the root of the question in the way that you're talking about.
Well, certainly, if you don't deal with the front end of this process, it's going to be very hard to, you know, really get at the root of this, because mass incarceration should not be understood as just an expression of how many people are in prison. It's maybe more accurate to look at what Marie Gottschalk says about the development of a carceral state, in which the whole state is organized around punitive social control mechanisms targeting the poor and the non-white and the immigrant. And so this suffuses not just into prisons and courts and policing, but into the delivery of social services, youth programs, treatment programs. It's all suffused with this coercive and punitive ideology. This is the problem with relying on things like drug courts. We're finding increasingly that the services that people are sent to by these drug courts are driven by the same punitive outlook that treat people as incapable of making real decisions for themselves, belittles them, looks at their problem as ones of individual moral failing, and then fails to provide the kinds of services that people really need, like access to stable housing, stable employment, adequate health care, et cetera. So I hope that this book will put policing on the map in terms of our discussions about mass incarceration, but also the broader punitive ideology that's driving all of this.
Well, many would say it's time for a bold vision. I'm reminded, though, of an op-ed I just saw a few days ago saying that calling for universal health care is going to reelect Donald Trump. It seems like people who want things really to change are seen as antagonists, not just of conservatives or the right wing, but of many people who define themselves as centrist. You sort of get this feeling of, oh, we also want this social change that you're calling for, but if you really push for it, well, then you're to blame for anything that happens. It's hard not to hear a kind of go slow, which I just wonder, you know, that seems something we have to fight against as well. Bold ideas require courage, and not least the courage to kind of hold one another up when we're being attacked as being, you know, somehow the real reason that we can't see any change.
Well, I have two thoughts on that. One is that if we embrace supposed reforms to policing that just re-empower the police and re-legitimize the police without really addressing the negative consequences of what they're doing, then we haven't really accomplished anything, and we've actually maybe made things worse. The other is that policing is overwhelmingly a local concern, and the vast majority of policing happens in major urban areas, the majority of which are run by Democrats. And so we should not be paralyzed about broader national political trends in trying to do something about this. Wherever you're listening to this, there are local politicians who are empowering the police to be a coercive force in a way that lets them off the hook from engaging in real problem solving that will produce real justice for people. And we can do something about that wherever we are.
Well, I'll just ask you finally, when we last spoke, the book was forthcoming. Now it's out. Has the response been what you expected?
Well, it's been out for a week or two, and, you know, I've had some very positive reviews and feedback. I'm waiting to hear more from the sort of mainstream police scholarship community, more from police, many of whom I know are reading the book, and also from elected officials who I know are reading the book. So I'm still waiting to get more feedback, if you will, and to see what the reaction is like.
All right, then. Well, we've been speaking with Alex Vitale. The book is The End of Policing. It's out now from Verso. Alex Vitale, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're most welcome.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Science is about questions and the struggle to answer them. Well, so is life. We question everything we think we know about climate science, or whether forests can create their own weather. Before I introduce our next guest, let me read just two sentences from a paper she co-authored in 2004. We present quantitative evidence suggesting that the persistence of an environment suitable for life, for any appreciable period of time, is only possible as long as a substantial area of the planet's surface is occupied by natural ecosystems, undisturbed by anthropogenic activities. Once the natural biotic mechanism of environmental control is destroyed, both local and global environment rapidly, over a timescale of hundreds of years, degrade to a state unfit for life, even if any direct anthropogenic environmental impact like industrial pollution is absent. That short summary contains a world of meaning. The authors are Viktor G. Gorshkov and Anastasia Makareva. Both are from the Theoretical Physics Division of the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute in St. Petersburg, Russia. The pair have issued a number of papers that have stirred global discussion. Our next interview comes from a scientist and theorist who shakes things up. I expect to learn from her. No doubt you and I will not agree with everything she says. I will save my comments until after the interview.
Radio EcoShock.
Our guest, Anastasia Makareva, received her Ph.D. in mathematics and physics, including atmospheric physics, from St. Petersburg State University. She's now a senior researcher in the physical and biological basis of life stability. From St. Petersburg, Russia, Anastasia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to have this chance for discussion. Why don't we start with that powerful quote from your 2004 paper with Viktor? You present the idea that our life-sustaining environment depends on large parts of the planet operating without our interference. Many think that is true, but how could you prove that scientifically?
Well, to prove this, we need to actually to do a multidisciplinary research, because it is a view on life as a program. You see, we all know that life makes an impact on the environment where it exists. But this environment is not physically stable. For example, if we look at climate, we have many destabilizing positive feedbacks, one of which is the feedback, the role of water vapor and its impact on temperature. So we cannot explain from physical grounds why our climate is stabilized at the global mean temperature that we observe at around 14 degrees Celsius. And when we study these mechanisms of climate stability, we came to the conclusion that the only mechanism that could impose a stabilizing impact is a mechanism of biotic nature. So it is life itself.
Well, let's follow up on your idea. Suppose our civilization managed to clean up industrial pollution and humans expand, but with clean technology. Even then, you say, if we go too far into those lands where nature operates, we will lose a planet fit to live on. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. This is what we are saying. And you see, this is the main idea. If the environment is not stable by itself, but it is stabilized by the biota, by natural ecosystems, then if we remove the stabilizing impact, then we can no longer enjoy stability of climate and environment.
Well, one final point from that 2004 paper, you claim that the acute threats we face today justify rethinking, quote, the foundations of ecological science. So do you think science is working or is it failing us in some ways?
I think that the dominant view on the biosphere is not correct. The idea that life regulates the environment and makes it stable was proposed by Lovelock. And biotic regulation, which we developed, my co-author Viktor Gorshkov, he developed it independently, but this idea was proposed by Lovelock. And he was criticized. And he he had the same arguments, the same ideas that without a stabilizing impact, the environment is not stable. But he was criticized on the grounds that this regulation of the environment by the biota cannot be sustained by natural selection, because there will certainly appear a cheater, some organism which will not regulate the environment but will benefit from the regulation by other organisms, and finally they will outcompete all these good regulating biota, and so any regulation by the biota is unstable in the long run as evolution proceeds with these cheaters. Do you understand me?
Yes, but we may be the cheaters.
Yes, yes, yes. But this discussion about the role of the biosphere ended at this point. So many biologists and ecologists cannot accept the existence of this regulation because of these arguments put forward by neo-Darwinists. But as we as physicists and theoreticians, we are concerned about quantitative estimates. And when we looked at this debate, no one has estimated the probability that such a cheater will appear. Because those who supported biotic regulation, they said to the neo-Darwinists, and how can you explain that the environment has remained suitable for life through all these nearly 4 billion years of life existence? And they say, oh, yes, this is all, it is either anthropic principle, so if it hadn't been so, we wouldn't have been talking now, or they say, life, whatever happened on Earth, there were always some genetic variants that could adapt to this change. So they say that whatever occurs on Earth, there is always a suitable genetic variant to survive. But this is also very improbable. You see, if you try to calculate, which they didn't do, how probable it is that for any change that may occur, any random environmental change, and for all of them that had occurred during life existence, there is always a suitable variant. It is a very improbable event. And the same improbable event is the appearance of a cheater. So, actually, it may well happen that the program of life is indeed vulnerable to the appearance of such cheaters, but through all these billions of years, the cheater has not arrived, and the program has been working. And the cheater, or a powerful cheater, like humans, of course, are, appeared only now, but the program is still working. So for science, it is very important to establish right now either there is a program and it is still working and we need to somehow suppress the cheater, or there isn't any program, it is all anthropic principle, and life has been adapting to changing conditions through all this time of its existence. And either there is a program or there isn't. It is very important, and it is what was completely missed in Gaia and Gaia studies because of very unfortunate choice of the model, these daisies, white and black daisies. It is not didn't capture the essence of the program, of the problem. Our society is now becomes more and more information-oriented. People begin to realize that actually biological systems are also information systems. And for example, in biology, there is now an active discussion where death is programmed and aging, whether they are programmed. Because if there is a program of death of an organism, then we can find it, for example, in humans, switch it off and live much longer. So I want to emphasize that it is very important to decipher what genetic information which contains in the genomes of species which compose natural ecosystem, what does this genetic information carry? Does it carry a program or of environmental regulation or it doesn't? Because if it does, we could use it for our benefits. And if it does, if we destroy natural ecosystems, it won't function for our benefits. And we will have problems which we cannot even anticipate because we don't know what and how this program is working. And I want to give you an example that it is not just an academic problem which can interest only theorists. You know the problem of the missing sink in the global carbon budget. It is a problem of direct relevance to the global warming, to the carbon emissions, and et cetera, et cetera. The problem is, and it was formulated a few decades ago, that when it was clear that carbon is accumulating, CO2 is accumulating in the atmosphere, people saw that not all that we emit via fossil fuel burning, not all this carbon actually accumulates in the atmosphere. Something is missing. People soon realized that a certain part is absorbed by the ocean, because the ocean came out of the physico-chemical equilibrium which it was in during the pre-industrial era. So as it was returning to this equilibrium, it absorbed some carbon, but it was not enough. So, for example, say we know how much we burnt, how much fossil fuel we burnt, how much CO2 is emitted. We knew how much is accumulating in the atmosphere thanks to the works of Keeling and others. And we knew, using measurements in the ocean, how much the ocean absorbs, but still there was no match. So the budget, we couldn't close the budget. And then, because it was already known that the biosphere is an active player, you see, there are, by the order of magnitude, about 1,000 gigatons of CO2 carbon, but the same amount of carbon in organic form is stored in the terrestrial biota. There is also, excluding soil, there is also soil biota. And also, we knew that there are very active processes of synthesis and decomposition at around 100 gigatons a year. So those geophysicists who knew only this about the biota, they began to think, oh, there must be something with the biota. And from our point of view, from the biotic regulation point of view, and we wrote it in our papers on this topic at that time, of course, the biota, if it had the program of environmental regulation, it must have been reacting to this pollution and taking this excessive polluting carbon from the atmosphere. So undisturbed biota, where this program is in action, must have been doing just that. And it is a very complex problem. We don't know how it works. So, for example, if you cut a finger, you don't know in detail how your organism heals this problem. But you do know that it maintains the homeostasis, and something will be done, and ultimately the skin will regenerate. So from this general principle, we could predict that the biota will react. Meanwhile, traditional ecology is dominated by the view that functioning of the biota is limited by biogens that are present in the smallest relative quantities. Or in simple words, it is limited by nitrogen or phosphorus. And since this nitrogen, as we all know, those people who grow something in their gardens know that we must put fertilizers to improve productivity. And so they said that since the nitrogen was not growing, only carbon, so many, many ecologists said that they didn't believe that the biosphere could be a global sink of carbon. And so this missing sink has been present in the literature for decades. And only when they were faced with direct measurements showing that the biota, indeed, the trees indeed improved, increased productivity and started taking more carbon from the atmosphere, only then the most recent papers mentioning this program are dated by this decade, so it is a recent issue still mentioning missing thing. So only then this mechanism was accepted. And why? Because they could ultimately measure this effect. Literally, people across the world went to the forest, measured trees, and tried to then extrapolate this to the globe as a whole. But as they still felt that it is a sink, which is not very, they were not very comfortable that it exists, so they, in their other estimates of the carbon budget, they reduced the other sources such that to make this sink as small as possible. And for example, carbon emissions from land use change, they become smaller. Currently, in the carbon budget, land use changes So how much carbon is emitted by soil erosion and things like this have the highest relative uncertainty. And since people want to make this missing thing, this uncomfortable thing, smaller, this means that the land use source is also made smaller within the uncertainty ranges. And so actually, it can well be that our disturbance of the atmosphere with land use is much larger than we currently think.
You are tuned to the one and only Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, scientist Anastasia Makareva from the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute in Russia. Now, following up almost exactly from what you've just said, we have new science from the Woods Hole Research Center just coming out about the role of tropical forests as now a source of carbon. They find that about 69% of carbon loss from those forests comes not from direct deforestation like logging, but from simple degradation and disturbance by humans. And that reminds me exactly of your 2004 paper about human free spaces and what you've just been talking about.
Yes, exactly. And one thing that people rarely mention, how the reaction, a stabilizing reaction of the biota to disturbance is necessarily a reaction of the community as a whole. So it is not trees that remove pollution, that remove excessive carbon. It is the whole community, because what does it mean to remove carbon? It means that the biota must store it in some inactive form within the ecosystem. So it must synthesize some inactive organic substance and store it. Only in this, owing to the metaconservation, it is the only way to remove carbon. And imagine that you are, say, a bacterium sitting in soil and suddenly finding that there is more organic matter synthesized, and you live on this, on eating this, actually. But in order to ensure a stabilizing response, this bacterium must ignore this excessive organic matter and allow it to accumulate. So the whole community of autotrophs and heterotrophs must act in cooperation, and only in this case there will be a net reaction, a net stabilizing reaction. But now, modern science views it in very simplistic form, like trees are being fertilized by carbon. Now, they are forced to accept it. But in fact, it is not trees that are doing it. It is the whole community that reacts in a coordinated manner. And since all organisms act based on their genetic information, based on their genomes, what is written in them, so it is a realization of this genetic program of environmental stabilization. So actually, we spent a lot of time studying the carbon cycle, and not knowing in detail how the biota works, still studying the cycle, it is possible to calculate the strength of this stabilizing feedback. And then we can calculate how much of natural biota globally we need such that it fully stops accumulation of carbon in the atmosphere, even if we don't stop emitting carbon and still continue with fossil fuels and so on. So this is just an example that relying on this mechanism that is already functioning, if we study it, if we quantify it, we could rely on it such and make it work for us and solve our environmental problems.
Now, our recent Radio EcoShock guest, Dr. Douglas Scheel from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, he works to study and preserve tropical forests, and he cited your work in something called a biotic pump. Can you briefly tell us what is a biotic pump?
Yes. Besides carbon, water is, of course, a major substance of importance for life. So a general prediction of the biotic regulation concept would be that natural ecosystems must be able to regulate and sustain and maintain in optimal conditions their water regime. And so we have been always interested in this topic. But when in 2005, we got a new friend, a new colleague from Brazil, Antonio Nobre, and he provides us a lot of information on the Amazon rainforest and the hydrological cycle. And then we realized that there is a very peculiar pattern observed in all forested river basins in the world. But in contrast to unforested areas, where precipitation rapidly declines with distance from the ocean, in forested regions of the world, including the Siberia, the Russian boreal forest region, the Amazon, Congo, and partially Canada, precipitation remains nearly constant or even grows with distance from the ocean. And since a certain part of precipitation goes to the river runoff and so is lost, it looked like something is pumping this water, and the only way water can come to deep inland is from the ocean. So it looked like the forest was pumping the moisture from the atmosphere. And we began to think, what could the physical mechanism of this biotically mediated moisture transport be? And then, using some previous results we obtained in 2002 about the non-equilibrium distribution of water vapor in the atmosphere, we realized that since moist atmosphere is unstable to condensation, if the forests keep the atmosphere moistened, then they will initiate condensation and the rising air motion over the forest. And this rising air motion will facilitate drawing moisture in the lower atmosphere from the ocean deep inland. And this fact that precipitation at a given latitude does not decline with distance from the ocean, this is indicative of a controlling influence the forest imposes on this process of moisture transport.
Can I assume that those forests doing the transporting have to remain more or less as a chain from the ocean to the inland, and that if we cut off an intervening forest, would that change the rainfall further inland?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And as we wrote already in our first paper on the topic, this provides an explanation for the partially mysterious disappearance of vegetation cover in Australia, which approximately, very approximately, coincides with large uncertainty with the arrival of humans. And here the mechanism could be that humans who settled on the oceanic coast doing fishing and so on, they destroyed, probably by fires, the coastal belt of vegetation, and thus they cut off the biotic pump of the inner forest from its source of moisture. And then this inland forest would perish, and this ecological catastrophe would have left no measurable trace, so it would be just instantaneous. And this could explain why so little evidence can be collected about this abrupt transition. And also, recent research shows that humans similarly might have contributed to the desertification of Sahara, which occurred several thousand years ago. Of course, we don't exclude geophysical factors, which are always at play. But in the presence of geophysical factors, humans can contribute to the local vegetation being unable to withstand these unfavorable geophysical factors and switches. So, for example, in the subtropical regions where there is, at the border of the Hadley and Ferrel cells, where there is this massive descending motion of air which suppresses condensation and makes everything drier. So these regions are particularly vulnerable to disturbances in vegetation. And so nature might have been able to cope with these problems and to establish in these difficult regions, but it was difficult for the ecosystem. And when humans came to these vulnerable regions, they contributed to some unfavorable geophysical processes like whatever they could be, switch off oceanic circulation, large scale or something. And these fragile ecosystems, which could have lived as they were without humans, they perished. And desertification followed, and it appeared irreversible. So it cannot now switch back to the to a moistened regime.
Okay, now I want to say that listeners can find a good description of the biotic pump theory and bioregulation at the website www.bioticregulation.ru, and you can find that also in English. And I'll put links to all the science we're talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is scientist Anastasia Makareva from St. Petersburg, Russia. Now, your work has been published in some of the top scientific journals, including the Proceedings of the Royal Society and in Physics Letters. Yet, your 2008 paper on hurricanes was eventually rejected by Atmospheric Chemistry Physics, the open access journal of the European Geosciences Union. What were you saying about hurricanes, and does that tell us anything about the huge, devastating hurricanes we've just seen sweeping the Caribbean, Florida, and Texas?
You see, indeed, this paper in 2008 was rejected, and as I was younger that time, it was actually a very painful event for us. But, you know, later we published the same things in other journals, but the matter is that since we are theorists, we seek quantitative estimates. And when we proposed that the biotic pump depends on the intensity of condensation, we naturally wanted to perform a self-check, because without a biotic pump, there is a lot of condensation which occurs over the ocean. And the most spectacular processes involving condensation are hurricanes. So we asked ourselves, if we are right in that condensation over forest draws these mild, moist winds towards the forest, we must be able to describe the generation of kinetic energy of hurricane winds on the same basis, and to show that here too, the hurricane intensity is proportional to condensation rate. And that is what we tried to do, and actually accomplished, I think, quite well. So we consider it to be our success, and we are very fond of this research of hurricanes. And we confirmed our prediction that indeed, and showed that indeed, hurricane intensity is proportional to condensation rate, exactly as we predicted in our theoretical framework. But in terms of implications, it means that actually hurricanes and forests compete for atmospheric moisture. If there is a big forest which draws oceanic moisture inland to feed rivers and life and all life on land, then hurricanes will have less moisture and there will be a lower probability of hurricanes to develop. You see, this is the main practical conclusion. And conversely, if we destroy forests and destroy this moisture transport of water vapor from over the ocean to land, then there is more moisture remaining over the ocean, and hurricanes can have plenty of food, and they can have a greater probability of developing and becoming more intense.
All right. Now, you went even further to suggest a new theory of wind, and that also brought some scientific criticism. Can you tell us about that theory?
Actually, this is not a new theory of winds, but we just see that condensation plays a major role in generating winds. You see, this is a very long-standing problem in atmospheric sciences. It was formulated already by Lorentz in 1960s or even earlier, that we must understand why the atmospheric power has the observed value. What does it mean? We know that wind energy dissipates. You see, it is not eternal. Winds are generated by pressure gradients and dissipate into smaller eddies and ultimately to heat. So this process of dissipation of wind energy is counteracted by generation of wind energy, and this generation is known to be about 1% of the order of 1% of the incoming solar energy. And so Lorentz asked and posed this problem that we must understand why it is so, why it is 1%, why it is not a hundredth of percent, or why it is not 10%, and what determines this figure. And since then, there was no answer given to this question from the atmospheric theory. You see, because global circulation models, in global circulation models, you can model any desirable atmospheric power by tuning friction. So global circulation models are just fitted to produce the same, the observed power. And there are no, just no theoretical expressions which will explain why this power has the observed magnitude. And when we propose that actually it is condensation that is responsible for generation of winds, we showed that the predicted expression, which we predict for this power using the observed precipitation rates, which are more or less well known, we obtain a figure that agrees satisfactorily with independent observations. And this result is often misinterpreted because people are saying that we deny all other mechanisms of wind formation, that we, I don't know what. No, we don't deny anything, any well-established physics about the atmosphere. We're a very strong, in our opinion, piece of evidence which suggests that it is condensation and the non-equilibrium distribution of water vapor in the gravitational field of Earth, and that this property of our atmosphere is responsible for the fact that wind generation, the generation of wind power on Earth, is proportional to condensation and precipitation. That's our main result.
Anastasia, what is your position on climate change?
My position on climate change is that humans have contributed enormously to devastating the biosphere. If we look from, say, from 1860 to 2005, the degree of anthropogenic disturbance of the biosphere has grown from 4% of land to about 30%. And we know that vegetation is responsible for evaporation on land and that this process captures about half of solar radiation, latent heat. And so if you imagine that you disturb vegetation, which on such a big area, 30%, and that you disturb this process of evaporation, which is about 80 watts per square meters, this could provide very significant changes to radiation balance of the Earth, which is comparable to radiative forcing, which is now said to be warming the Earth. So this process, in our view, has contributed, the process of destroying natural vegetation has contributed to those climatic changes that we are now observing.
But you haven't mentioned fossil fuels. You've made a biological explanation for climate change. Do you include fossil fuels as a powerful force as well?
The matter is that as I haven't done global circulation modeling, unlike other people, I cannot tell you that I am convinced in those numerical estimates of the effects of carbon on, and that carbon is fossil fuel emissions are as responsible for the observed climate change as, say, I don't know, IPCC is saying or something. Moreover, recent publications, which I don't very much follow because now we are doing other things, but specifically for this talk, I looked through some publications and it appears that this uncertainty is becoming to be recognized in the mainstream media, like the recent publication in the Bulletin of American Meteorological Society, something like the science and art of model tuning or something. This idea is that rather than stemming directly from physics, from physical constraints, this climate sensitivity to CO2 can be to a large degree tuned within an anticipated range. You know, in Russia there is a very special situation. What is very special situation when all ecologists who were saying something against industrial expansion were termed like something like deniers of the national good. So I am very sensible to this idea that everyone who says something against this carbon topic is immediately in the American press labeled as a denier. But you should understand that this uncertainty, given this uncertainty, placing so much emphasis on carbon is dangerous because it is overlooking probably more important drivers of climate change. For example, as a scientist who is convinced that the biota, the role of the biota is drastically underestimated, I cannot remain emotionally neutral to such ideas like, for example, the spread of biofuel. The advancement of biofuel, which is said to be carbon neutral, goes exactly against what I as a scientist hold, because if we are concerned only about fossil fuel emissions, then we can actually deforest land and grow biofuel on these territories, and it's okay. But if the biosphere keeps our climate suitable for us, it will be a suicide, a crime against humanity. You see, so while IPCC, for many environmental activists, definitely for regreening and things like that, all green things. In fact, this emphasis on carbon is, from the point of view of the biota, it is close to a crime, because biofuel expansion is a recognized driver of deforestation. So how can we, knowing increasingly that these carbon estimates are so uncertain, to base such policies on that, destroying policies? And another thing, a very important one, clouds are a major component of uncertainty. Clouds. Now, based on the same models which say that carbon is the main component of global warming, the same models promote the statement that actually deforestation and desertification is good because the albedo becomes higher and so more sunlight is reflected and so the earth becomes cooler. It is also such an irresponsible, just irresponsible papers. The last one I read appeared in Climate Dynamics, a Canadian journal, a mainstream one. Huge uncertainties. They add up negative and positive values of similar magnitude and play on the resulting net number, which is highly uncertain. And they publish such things. Then I recently talked to a woman who was fighting for 20 years to protect the Great Barrier Rainforest in British Columbia. And I recently wrote to her, as well as other colleagues, that if these foresters had this paper in their hands, they could not have reached an agreement which now protects a large part of this forest against deforestation. Those people said, oh, you see, we deforest everything, we make a desert, and we are okay, we are helping our planet not to die from warming.
Wow. So now what? Do you and Gorshkov spend your time further proving your large body of work? Or do you have new citadels of science to question? Do you have new research in the works or awaiting publication?
Oh, yes, of course we are continuously working. We have a very large program. And you see that this biotic regulation is a multidisciplinary concept. So we need to have some expertise in all fields. Because one problem, why this biotic regulation, as our readers sometimes ask us, why is not your biotic regulation known more widely? And we are saying because it requires to be appreciated, it requires the person has knowledge of problems in many disciplines. Meanwhile, modern science is very compartmentalized. For example, all climate science is dominated by people, and historically was dominated by people, probably less so recently, who don't know anything about the biota. They knew nothing. These were technical folks who wrote and programmed their equations, and that's it. So, but the biotic regulation requires a synthesis of knowledge from fields as diverse as genetics and climatology. And it is not a philosophical construction, but in every field we are trying to come forward with quantitative estimates demonstrating the strength of the effects we are describing.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I don't know. I myself spend a lot of time in natural forests and near the sea, and because it is very important for a theorist not just to write some formula, but also have these intrinsic measurements when you see, when you hear. And I want just to say that when we discovered the biotic pump, it was a very high-spirited, very deep emotion of like your eyes opened and we understood what trees actually, what trees are actually doing. So it is not a scientific thing, but now we feel even more tremendous respect for trees because it is really magnificent organisms created by nature, and they are able to drive these global scale processes like moisture transport and keeping this moisture in soil and initiating condensation, which is needed. So these are really, they are like gods. And so when you look at the tree, just think of it.
We have been speaking with Dr. Anastasia Makareva from the Petersburg Nuclear Physics Institute in St. Petersburg, Russia. Please explore the website at bioticregulation.ru. Or you can look for links to the half dozen papers and articles we've talked about in my weekly show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Anastasia, it's been a real treat talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Before you get that nasty email ready, yes, I did hear Anastasia describe global warming as a biological phenomenon caused by humans. She dodged the role of fossil fuel emissions, which most scientists on this program cite as the leading driver of climate change. Let's break this problem up into two parts. First, Dr. Makareva is a state-funded scientist in Russia, a country whose largest single exports are oil and gas. Although nominally a democracy, the Kremlin discourages climate activism and may remove academics who, as they see it, threaten the national interest. We could say it is in the interests of the current government to dismiss criticism of fossil fuels and to sow doubt about the real causes of climate change. But who are we talking about, Russia or the Trump administration, which is dismantling climate science and appointing deniers to key posts. The current government of Australia is not much better. Canada is just emerging from 10 years of muzzling climate scientists. There are scientists in many countries who cannot say all they would. The second part is more subtle and, I think, more important. As you heard in this interview, Anastasia Makareva is passionate about forests and the living world. She sees the important role of biology in controlling climate being lost in the noise about fossil fuels only. Makareva is not alone in that. I hear fairly regularly from forest campaigners who see vast areas being lost, whether it's in the boreal or in Brazil. They just had huge losses in Brazil again. But to get funding, these forest campaigners have to stress the carbon role, the climate angle. We could expand that to anti-nuclear campaigners and activists who are fighting off bee-killing pesticides or other poisonous wastes. It's fair to say that the general destruction of the planet can at times get lost in our fixation on the singular doom of climate change and fossil fuels. Even so, the vast majority of the world's scientists do say the most immediate threat to a livable climate comes from human-induced climate emissions and from fossil fuel burning in particular. If we carry on with the carbon economy as it is, you know and I know that civilization as we know it may not survive. I will have more to say about this interview with Dr. Makareva in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. I appreciate her joining us on Radio EcoShock. Just a couple of years ago, the climate solutions we heard from pundits and governments was mostly about industrial solutions to industrial pollution. How times have changed. A new paper coming out in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences outlines 20 steps we can take to work with nature instead. The effort was led by the Nature Conservancy, with 32 authors from a slew of universities and countries. If we are going to have a habitable future, this may be it. Lewis Bloomberg is the director of the California Climate Change Program of the Nature Conservancy's California chapter. He has a long history in climate solutions while working for the EPA and the state of California. Lewis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, I appreciate you showing up. I want to bring you up to speed here. As listeners know, we've heard Anne-Marie Eldering of NASA and Alessandro Bacini from Woods Hole tell us that the tropics have flipped from being a carbon sink to becoming a carbon source. Climate change threatens to make this the new normal. Lewis, did your team find ways to turn this around?
Well, our new paper that was released this week confirms that natural climate solutions are an important and essential tool in the effort to combat climate change. We're using the latest analysis showing that improvements in how we manage our forests, farms, ranches, and wetlands can generate significant benefits to the atmosphere, ultimately 37% of the emission reductions that are needed to keep warming below 2 degrees centigrade.
Now, protecting natural lands is the mission of the Nature Conservancy. I wonder, when did your organization realize they were becoming climate fighters as well?
Well, Alex, I've been with the Nature Conservancy 14 years, and so that started before my time. I've been working on the role of nature and climate since 2000, but the Nature Conservancy started somewhere around 1991 or two, as far as I know, looking at efforts to stop tropical deforestation.
To get to this paper, we've already been misled by things like clean coal, carbon credits, carbon offsets. Why should we not be suspicious of this new label, natural climate solutions?
Well, Alex, we are not suspicious of forest carbon offsets. In fact, in California, they're working really well. And there's a long history that the Nature Conservancy has working with the state of California to make these real, dependable, reliable emission reductions. So that said, I think with natural climate solutions, this is just the next step, if you will, moving beyond forest offsets. This is looking at how we manage our forests, farms, ranches, and wetlands. We know that we can do better and at the same time generate benefits to the atmosphere while managing these lands better.
Could you please give us in detail two examples of natural climate solutions?
Well, I guess a couple of examples. So I would start with the Garcia River Forest in Mendocino County, which is 24,000 acres, about 14,000 hectares. It's a property that we worked with the partner called the Conservation Fund to purchase in 2002. And in 2004, we set up the first forest carbon offset project there on that property. So this is a what we call natural forest management. So this is land that was redwood forest that was heavily cut over, and we, with the Conservation Fund, have implemented a sustainable logging plan that's generating significant amount of climate benefits, about 4 tons per acre per year in measurable natural climate solutions outcomes, if you will. And then I would like to highlight the efforts in the California Delta, and that land is wetlands that has very carbon-rich peat soils. And there we're working with scientists and others to demonstrate how restoration of the wetlands can generate significant benefits to the atmosphere while also creating habitat for wildlife and protecting the local community from increased flood risk and saltwater intrusion, both of which will be amplified by climate change.
Still, personally, I doubt we can take out enough food, enough fiber for 9 to 12 billion projected humans, all of whom want a modern, full-scale life. Won't those needs overwhelm the efforts to employ nature as a kind of carbon control?
Well, in the paper, we're ensuring that we maintain the current food supply. And then looking to the future, we are working with partners and ranchers in many places, including Brazil and in Indonesia, for what we call supply chain strategies. We're working to help create more food on the same number of acres to remove the incentive to change land management.
Lewis, prior to this paper, what did experts say was the maximum potential of natural climate solutions? And then what did your new team discover?
Well, our paper discovered that the potential is about 30% more than was previously forecasted in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this is because, in part, that we looked at more pathways. We looked at more opportunities. So we know that avoided deforestation was one that people have looked at for many years. But we also looked at, well, what would happen if you actually avoided forest conversion or reforestation, or if you planted trees in the croplands. So we looked at more options here, more opportunities, and that gave us a greater percentage outcome, if you will, 30% more.
We recently had a Russian scientist on the show suggesting that enhancing natural biology could sequester enough carbon to allow us to continue burning fossil fuels. What do you think?
I don't agree with that. I think we need to continue to reduce emissions from the energy sector and from the transportation sector, where we've made progress. But the issue here with this paper is that natural climate solutions are not getting the same kind of attention that the energy and the transportation sectors are. We will not meet our climate goals if we don't address how our lands are managed. And what the paper shows us, and what we're learning here in California on a similar paper that we're working on, is that we can get really large, meaningful reductions, greenhouse gas reductions, from changes in how we manage our lands.
You know, I remember just 4 years ago, all I heard about was carbon capture and storage, and governments and think tanks were actually proposing that we build great big pipelines that would capture the slurry and pump it down into old wells, and it was a huge industrial solution. And now instead I'm hearing a lot of what you're talking about, that the forests and the natural lands could help us a lot more than that.
Well, carbon capture and storage is an idea. It's a experiment, if you will. What natural climate solutions offer is really the low-hanging fruit. Natural climate solutions are quick. We can do this now while we work on other technologies for the future. Natural climate solutions are also cost-effective. We found that a third of the reductions that we're talking about are available at less than $10 a ton. They're cheap right now. They're quick, they're cheap, and they provide a whole suite of other benefits that we've talked about, including biodiversity and food, as well as clean water for people all over the world.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Lewis Bloomberg from the Nature Conservancy in California. We're talking about published new science showing natural climate solutions. Do you think there is a path to staying under 2 degrees C without a massive new stewardship of nature?
No.
But yet, I'm uncomfortable that humans need to run nature to survive. I mean, we have a tendency to build roads to take the resources and overwhelm indigenous cultures as we try to help. Other people have suggested, well, we should just stay away, leave the land untouched. How does the team of scholars address that tough issue?
Well, Alex, the human activities have impacted every acre of the planet. You can go into the wilderness areas high in the mountains. You can go to the Arctic areas. You can go to the savannas of Australia, where the fire regime has been disrupted. So, you know, a hands-off policy is not going to make the changes that are necessary in greenhouse gas emissions in order to keep the planet habitable for the future.
And I notice in your bio that you were once the Deputy Director of External Affairs for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. What do you make of the recent deadly wildfires in California, where we have a lot of stations, and do you see them as a definite climate signal?
Well, I think the fires in Northern California are a major tragedy. Over 40 people have died. There have been 5,000 homes and other structures destroyed. The fires are still burning, and we've had fires ignite in the last week in other parts of the state. So wildfire is a terrible tragedy here. It is one of many extreme events, and this is just what the scientists have predicted. We do know that climate change creates the conditions that will make extreme events more frequent and more severe. And that's just what we've seen in California. The analysis that's been done by the state of California, analysis that the Nature Conservancy worked to help support and fund, shows that the temperature has risen 1.8 degrees in Fahrenheit, the average land temperature in the state, as well as we just came out of a four-year drought. So we are seeing drier, hotter temperatures and conditions around the state, which lead to these larger fires, and that's just what's happening.
What does this new paper in PNAS add to the climate toolbox that maybe we didn't have before?
First of all, it really reinforces and clarifies the essential role that natural climate solutions play in addressing climate change. We will not succeed in meeting the ambitious reduction targets that we need to keep temperature below 2 degrees centigrade if we do not change how we manage our lands. So the paper reinforces strongly the reality and the imperative that we have to change how we manage our lands if we're going to achieve our climate goals. It also provides a menu of strategies that are available to all kinds of people, to landowners, to government officials, to NGOs, to people that really want to take this issue seriously and look at our land sector. So we've got a menu here of 20 different strategies, and you can pick and choose for what works in your area. And we also show here in the paper the connection between proper land management and protecting our water, our soil, our biodiversity, and our air quality.
Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
Well, I think that it's important that, for me at least, I draw some hope from the paper. You know, we can do this. It's not going to be easy, you know, and we need to get all hands on deck, and we need to be moving quickly. But here with the paper and with the work of the Nature Conservancy, we are hopeful because we do see an important and often overlooked pathway here, which is using natural climate solutions to aggressively fight climate change.
Our guest is Lewis Bloomberg. He is well known in conservation circles even before he became the director of the California Climate Change Program in that state's chapter of the Nature Conservancy. We've been talking about the new paper in PNAS titled Natural Climate Solutions. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. You can find your nearest chapter of the Conservancy at www.nature.org. Lewis, thank you for telling us a little bit of better news.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure talking with you today.
We are, as always, out of time for this week in Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for listening, and please join us again.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is the Taylor Report, 89.5 FM, CIUT. You can hear us on soundcloud.com/Taylor-report, Facebook.com/The Taylor Report. I believe we're joined now by Philip LaRochelle. Are you there, Philip?
Yes, I'm here.
Philip, thank you very much. You have a distinguished career. You have successfully.
Wow.
I'm sending you an award. It'll be in, it's in the mail. No, you did a brilliant job. People should know that. At the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, I had the pleasure of witnessing some days of your work in court. And my memory is your client was acquitted. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah, the first one, not the second one, but anyway,
so the award will come. And then, okay. But you have also been fighting a fight legal matter of very great relevance to Canada. You have been representing Leon Mugesera, a university professor who in 1994 was in Canada at the time of the calamitous events, the war and the massacre of civilians, leading later to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And Mugesera was in this country for, I believe, 19 years. But he was removed, and you were fighting his removal.
Yes.
And now he is in Rwanda, and you have taken his case to the
– wherever we can.
Pardon me?
I said we are taking his case wherever we can.
Wherever they're open, wherever court is open. It's the African Court for Human Rights and People's Rights in Arusha, Tanzania. So you at least didn't have any trouble finding it. But you won that. Tell us this little story. First of all, you fought that he should not be removed. Does this matter that the victory you just won?
It is connected. There is a loose connection, although there are two different fora. Mm-hmm. Just to go back to when we were fighting here on his behalf, so we had exhausted all remedies in Canada, the federal court and all of it. All of a sudden, there was nothing safe for the Committee Against Torture. So we fought, we made a complaint before the Committee Against Torture, and the Committee Against Torture requested Canada to wait before removing him. And so this it's in the context that we started fighting. This is why I pick up the fight. I went before the court here in Montreal, and I requested, by way of an injunction relief, that Canada should respect the request of the Committee Against Torture to postpone the removal up to a time where the Committee Against Torture could perform its assessment as to whether there was a risk of torture should he be sent back to Rwanda. And one of the arguments that the risk of torture had been argued throughout the court, and the main argument raised by Canada was the fact that they had obtained diplomatic assurances from Rwanda about not only about the fact that he would not be tortured, but about how the trial would take place, what kind of conditions he would be detained, access to his lawyer, access to his family, and so on and so forth. So that was before he was removed. Mm-hmm. So we went before the civil courts in Montreal. We initially obtained an injunction. The Canadian government eventually managed to have it lifted, and there he was sent back to Rwanda. On one end, the recourse before the Committee Against Torture carries on. We are still waiting for a decision on that. And there's been a lot that's been happening both in Canada and Rwanda regarding the value of diplomatic insurances and the risk that Canada is taking by removing people for Rwanda. Yes. So in the meantime, mm-hmm. So that's still ongoing. The Committee Against Torture procedure is ongoing. Normally, the briefs from Canada and our own briefs are finished, but now we are thinking of reopening the Committee Against Torture case, amongst other reasons, in light of what is taking place before the African Court, the African Court on Human and People's Rights. And that takes me to the African Court on Human and People's Rights. So the one of the first cases that was taken against Rwanda before that case is the case of Victoire Ingabire. And mm-hmm. you might remember that following the filing of a complaint by Victoire Ingabire, Rwanda simply decided to extract himself from the African Court on Human Rights. And such the removal of Rwanda was taking place on 1st March 2017. So before that was effective, we filed a complaint on behalf of Léon Mugesera before the African Court on Human and People's Rights on the day before it was due to expire, on 28th February 2017. And along with the complaint, we requested some interim measures, asking Rwanda to report on a variety of topics, including those that were the subject of diplomatic insurances by Canada, such as whether his trial was following due process, whether he had proper access to lawyers and family, there was also big complaints about how he was detained, medical needs that he has, a special diet, there was a lot of, in total, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, just regarding the judicial process. Then there are more regarding there are requests regarding various articles of the Charter, and they concern his detention, they concern his trial, they concern the way he has access to family and lawyers, mm-hmm. and on all these topics, the African Court of Human Rights has requested Rwanda provide the court with detailed answers about each of these topics. Mm-hmm. And basically, the decision of last 28 September 2017 is that. So it is not a decision on substance, if you will, about our complaint. It's a decision on the interim measures that we had requested at the time of filing our complaint. And as it is now, Rwanda had 2 weeks to respond, and we have yet to see an answer from Rwanda. So I think that speaks volumes in terms of how willing they are to respect the diplomatic insurance that they provided to Canada as well. So mm-hmm. since Canada has completely failed, as far as we know anyway, to follow up on the diplomatic insurances that they received from Rwanda, we definitely intend to link the result of the procedure before the African Court on Human Rights and People's Rights and the monitoring of those diplomatic insurances by Canada, as far as we know, it is completely absent.
No, this is Philippe LaRochelle. He's a Quebec lawyer and is representing Leon Mugesera. As you lay that out, Philippe, isn't it the case that Canada should argue that they were deceived by the Rwandans in that you pointed out Rwanda had signed on to this African court, behaving as though they were going to follow the procedures? But then when it comes time to look at the Mugesera case, then they simply withdraw.
I think it's not looking at the Mugesera. I think it's not because of the Mugesera case that they withdraw, because they withdrew after the Ingabire case.
Ingabire case.
So Ingabire. That's the last lady who had the infortune of running against Kagame.
But it still applies that they, in a sense, deceived Canada.
It does.
Because here they are the signatory of a respectable court and a procedure, and then when they get in hot water, they simply say, no, we don't play.
But it's regardless of the African Court on human and people's rights, I think what is that the real problem is relying on diplomatic entrances from a country that's run by a criminal organization. How can you rely on a gentleman's agreement when the party on the other side is a well-known criminal organization? I think that's where the real problem lies, as far as Canada is concerned. Mm-hmm. Then as far as Rwanda is concerned, for that court, this is just another indication of the complete lack of due process in that country. As soon as something doesn't fit within their views on how things should happen.
Well, there seems to be something wrong with our political culture that people are not addressing this. We've had a guest on this show, David Himbara, who the Canada acknowledges, the British government was the source, that his life was threatened by that criminal regime that you're speaking of. And so they have delivered into the hands of that criminal regime, Mr. Mugesera. And have not asked and not insisted that he be protected and get his rights. Tell us about – one assumed that there would be a fair trial. Did he get –
No, well, you can – yeah.
What kind of trial did he get?
It was a mockery of a trial, according to the reports we get from his lawyers. And this is why there's a lot of questions in this order for interim measures dealing with the exact conditions under which the trial took place. So what kind of judicial assistance did he get? What kind of translation? What kind of access to the case file, disclosure issues, access to witnesses, feasibility of obtaining the appearance of witnesses, considering the political character of the trial, and so on and so forth. So there's all these aspects. I don't know. I wasn't in Rwanda. I just get reports, vague reports from the lawyer who probably doesn't speak too much about how it happened.
By the way, didn't they actually end up charging his lawyer or trying to fine him quite a large amount of money?
That I'm not aware of. But I wouldn't rule it out.
Perhaps that's a detail.
That's really in the realm of possibility.
I have my own sources on these things.
I can see that.
Dangerous, actually. I mean, that's another matter, to practice law there. A colleague of yours was arrested when he tried to work in a Rwandan court.
Yeah, a while back, Peter Ellinger was definitely arrested when he did that. Yeah.
So what remedy now? I mean, you actually have this an interim decision by this court.
Well, now we are basically they add up until 28 September. So if I'm looking at the calendar here, their date is expired. They add up until last Friday to answer. So now is the time where are we taking this up now? So we are – I'm not alone in this case. I'm working with other lawyers, a professor in law. And we are considering a variety of possible follow-up procedures, I would say, either in Canada or before the African Court on Human Rights, and even other fora. Like, definitely we will keep the Committee Against Torture informed of the development in this case. Mm-hmm. And we are studying what kind of remedies are available even here in Canada, considering the fact that they were acting under the guise or the spell, I should say, sort of a mystic formula of diplomatic insurance. So these things definitely do not work in a case like that.
Yeah. again, is Philip La Rochelle. And your colleagues were Genevieve Dufour of Sherbrooke.
And David Pavot. David Pavot and Genevieve Dufour of Sherbrooke University, who also did a tremendous amount of work in this case. They run a student human rights clinic there, and they decided to get on board very early on. And
so this thing
would not have been possible without their help.
Their students were involved as well.
Sorry? They basically, students get credit for that. They work very hard, and it counts towards their session. And they are supervised by teachers, the teachers Pavot and Dufour. And it's also thanks to, and I would like to publicly thank them, because it's also thanks to them that we managed to pull this off.
Yeah. You know, of course, Mugesera partly is in problems because they made him a poster boy, in a sense, did they not? When the events happened in 94, suddenly he became the focus of a lot of publicity here. I remember listening to it on CBC radio, and it was as though he was a player. And I noticed they used the word political operative, but he was a university professor who at one time or another was an advisor to ministers in the government. But the word political operative makes him into kind of a power broker. So he's been
Not the case at all.
He's been misrepresented from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. That's why when you look at it from a different perspective, Canada has, within the legal box of things that are available, this trial could have been held here. You know, they did other ones in genocide cases here. In conditions which, you know, where you cannot question. Of course, there are always issues about access to evidence and the extent to which it is fabricated and manipulated when it emanates from Rwanda. But at least here, you are satisfied that you have an independent judiciary that can look at it in a more serene way than any judge in Kigali will really feel at risk of taking a view that may diverge from, you know, the usually accepted views of the regime.
Mm-hmm. Philip, thank you very, very much. It's Philip La Rochelle and a brilliant defense team and students who've really been doing their job. I wish this was going on across Canada. We might actually win some justice for Leon Mugesera and his family, who suffered now for more than 20 years. We want to follow this, of course, and you say at the end of the week there's...
At the end of last week, so we are currently studying what's next. So mm-hmm. I'll definitely keep you posted on what we do next.
Yeah, please do, and best wishes. We thank you very, very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's Philip La Rochelle. He is a brilliant lawyer from Quebec. There are many, and we are few. and anyway, we do congratulate them on their hard work, and it just shows. You should follow this. This is an individual who basically has been demonized. And there's, Phil, you may know the old saying, you can give a dog a bad name and kill it, right? Isn't that roughly how it goes?
That's certainly how this
the idea of the yellow dog is called.
Yeah. I think we should remind our listeners that when he was extradited, they went to the extraordinary step of not allowing him to face the witnesses against him, right? I think the witnesses were behind a screen or something when there was a Canadian.
There was some of that. That happens, by the way, now in all these courts.
Yeah.
And transparency is essential part of justice, and we tend not to get it.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Julian Tweeten, who talks about her recent article titled "How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left," which reveals how unaccountable tech companies are defining the parameters of acceptable discourse. Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California, who discusses the links between this year's devastating western U.S. wildfires and climate change, and excerpts of a Yale University speech by writer and climate activist Bill McKibben, who warns that while the situation is dire, the global battle against climate change is not over. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
This year's massive outbreak of cholera in war-torn Yemen could lead to 1 million cases of the bacterial disease before the end of the year, the fastest spreading such outbreak in modern history. The epidemic, which began in late April, now surpasses Haiti's cholera outbreak after the massive 2010 earthquake. Yemen is in the midst of a three-year civil war between Houthi rebels and a coalition backed by Saudi Arabia, supplied with U.S.-made weapons. Yemen's director of Save the Children called the cholera epidemic a man-made crisis, where the healthcare system is on the edge of collapse, children go hungry, and people are blocked from getting the medical treatment they need. The World Health Organization has reported more than 815,000 suspected cases of the disease in Yemen and 2,156 deaths thus far. About 4,000 suspected cases are being reported daily, more than half of which are among children under 18 years old. Over the summer, the international community pledged to supply 1 million doses of cholera vaccine to Yemen, but those plans were canceled due to the rapid spread of the disease. Now, the World Health Organization has established rehydration centers across the country, bringing in medical staff and providing cholera kits, which include supplies ranging from water purification tablets to soap and disinfectants. A month after Hurricane Maria tore through Puerto Rico, raw sewage is flowing into rivers and reservoirs which supply water to the island's 3.5 million people. Residents, most still without electricity, don't have clean water for drinking, bathing, and washing clothes. The situation has become so dire that some people have turned to tapping water from known polluted sources, including the Environmental Protection Agency's designated toxic pollution Superfund sites. As nearly half of Puerto Rico's sewage treatment plants are out of service, there is growing concern about an emerging public health crisis, according to the Associated Press. When Puerto Ricans bathe or wash their clothes with contaminated surface water drawn from lakes, rivers, creeks, and springs, they are at risk of becoming infected with bacteria like leptospirosis, which is caused when drinking water is contaminated with animal urine. Most Puerto Ricans now rely on bottled water and are warned to boil their water from all suspect sources. The current problems in Puerto Rico stem from an aging and inefficient energy infrastructure, dozens of toxic waste sites, and the most contaminated drinking water supply in the U.S. Now, tons of man-made debris and rotting vegetation clog streets and waterways, which threaten to produce a worsening trash and pollution crisis for months to come. About half of the country's 1.6 million prisoners have some sort of job behind bars. Though prisoners technically volunteer to work many of these jobs, nothing is really voluntary in prison. Nationally, prison labor provides many local and county public services. Every state now depends on inmates to clean and prepare meals in prisons. David Fathi of the American Civil Liberties Union's National Prison Project observed, when prisoners are used for cheap labor, there's a risk that our criminal justice policy will be hijacked by a desire to grow or maintain this literally captive labor force. In California, nearly 40% of those fighting dangerous wildfires are state prisoners who volunteered for $2 a day, or $1 an hour if they fought fires on the front lines. In 2014, as California Attorney General Kamala Harris argued in court, the state would lose a critical labor pool if inmates were granted early release due to prison overcrowding. Inmates have few legal protections regarding low-paid work, since they are not covered by minimum wage laws, nor have the right to organize unions. In recent years, prison industries have expanded to make license plates, uniforms, furniture, and engage in telemarketing. Not only does the public and private sector's use of prison labor create a perverse incentive to slow the momentum of prison sentencing reforms, but this push also decreases worker wages in communities, large and small, across America. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As congressional committees and special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation seeks evidence on charges that Donald Trump's presidential campaign had colluded with Russian government operatives to win the White House, independent journalism has emerged as an unlikely victim of the probe. An explosion of news stories highlighting charges that Russia sponsored an operation to plant fake news in U.S. social media in order to boost Trump during the 2016 election campaign has prompted online giants Google and Facebook to block access to what they label as offensive news websites. Unfortunately, dozens of progressive, left, and radical political websites have been blocked in this process and have since reported dramatic declines in their online traffic, the lifeblood of online news organizations. This marginalization of left media resulted in large part from major changes made to Google's search engine algorithm, designed, the company says, to combat fake news. Your reporter spoke with Julian Tweeten, who writes about the intersection of the technology industry and socioeconomic topics. Here she discusses important issues examined in her recent article titled "How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left," which reveals how unaccountable tech companies are defining the parameters of acceptable discourse.
The kind of premise of what I wrote is that there's this kind of confluence of the fake news narrative and of the Russiagate narrative. And the idea is that, you know, various kind of mainstream media sources, CNN, The Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera, have been really emphasizing the influence of Russia on, you know, the election, obviously. And in the process of kind of this narrative of Russian tampering with United States democracy, various technology companies have been kind of placed at the center. So Facebook, Google, Twitter, which all have tremendous capacity to disseminate information and to disseminate news stories. And so what's been going on kind of more recently, many pundits and kind of mainstream media sources are claiming that Russia has been tampering with Facebook and with Twitter. Russian agents have placed ads on Facebook and have created accounts on Twitter that have manipulated American citizens and the American voting citizenry. So that's kind of the latest development in this narrative. But what I found was that the idea of fake news is very nebulous. Since Google and Facebook have kind of been responding to these critiques of their complicity in disseminating fake news, left-leaning sites have suffered. So Google has updated its algorithms in order to kind of, quote, control for the spread of fake news. And in the process, sites like Alternet and the World Socialist website and Democracy Now! And several others have been found, have seen their search traffic decline. And so that's kind of the latest, again, the latest stirring in the ongoing fake news and kind of Russiagate narrative.
Julianne, can you explain a little bit more about the algorithm changes that we've seen at Facebook and how that has affected? And you can mention some of the statistics of the reduced readership that some of these important progressive sites have experienced as a result of that algorithm change.
That's actually more closely related to Google. In April, Google instituted several algorithmic updates in response specifically to accusations that it had helped to spread misinformation and, quote, fake news. And as a result of that, various sites saw their search traffic decline. So the World Socialist website reported that it had seen a 67% decrease in traffic between April and July of this year. So right after the algorithms were changed, a total decrease of 85%. Sites like Alternet, Democracy Now!, Common Dreams, and Global Research and Truthout also saw pretty significant declines in their search traffic. ranging from 49% to 71%, and Alternate claimed to have lost an average of 1.2 million of its 2.7 million unique visitors that it received from search traffic. And of course, Google has a search monopoly and generates the majority of search traffic for most websites. So it's pretty easily attributable to Google searches. So it's quite indicative of the power that Google can have on pretty much any website it wants, let alone one with a certain political identity.
These progressive media outlets, small, not very powerful, they are quite alarmed at what's going on here in the real reduction of their readership. What are they doing to push back? Are they capable of putting any counter pressure here to get back on some kind of even playing field in social media without being hobbled by these counter fake news operations?
Right. It's difficult for them because they are, you know, they're not in positions of power, certainly not compared to the monopolistic forces that provide their search rankings or present them to users on a large scale. I don't know exactly what the strategy is, but, you know, I think this speaks much more to a very, very large scale problem, which is monopoly capitalism. The fact that there are these private companies that have their own political motivations that play such a large role in how visible these sites can be. Perhaps some of these sites can take legal action. I think they're maybe more apt to try to organize in a more grassroots fashion. Again, I'm not entirely sure. I wish I knew more about that. But I do think that this should be used as an opportunity to really examine the effects of monopoly capitalism and of you know, giving such a small concentration of companies such immense power when so much is at stake.
That was journalist Julian Tweeten, who wrote the article titled "How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left," published by In These Times magazine. Find links to Tweeten's article and related material by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The early October wildfires that swept six Northern California counties, including Napa, Lake, Sonoma, Mendocino, Butte, and Solano, constitute the deadliest fires in California history. Officials reported that multiple blazes across the state killed 42 people and hospitalized nearly 200 others. The wildfires destroyed at least 8,400 homes and other structures and burned more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. An estimated 5,000 firefighters continue to battle 10 different fires across Northern California. Altogether, 100,000 people were displaced by the fires, leaving thousands of evacuees not knowing if they'll be able to find new homes in the region in the months and years ahead. All told, this year's California fires caused the largest loss of life due to fire in the U.S. since Minnesota's Cloquet Fire in 1918. Since the 1970s and early 80s, the number of large wildfires has increased more than 500% in federally managed forests across the western U.S. Questions are now being raised by many about why there's been such a dramatic rise in wildfires in recent years. According to scientists, the answer is climate change, in combination with other factors. Your reporter spoke with Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California at Merced. Here he explains how climate change has increased the frequency and destructive power of wildfires and will make the future incidents of these fires ever more dangerous.
So across the western United States, there has been a very dramatic increase overall in wildfire since the 1970s. Every decade since then has seen more fire, more large fires, more area burned in those fires, more high severity fires in places that didn't used to get high severity fire that frequently every decade. The thing to keep in mind is that there's a lot of diversity in the ecosystems and fire in those ecosystems within the West. So some places are much more sensitive to changes in temperature than others are. Now, these fires that we're talking about in California most recently, Sonoma and Napa counties in particular, are burning in a different kind of vegetation. So it's lower elevation, doesn't snow there. It's much warmer and drier in the summer. And so the temperatures that we've had are compounding this, but there's a lot more going on than just the temperatures. This last winter was a very wet winter, and that gave us a lot of extra fuel, but it was also very hot temperatures in the spring and into the summer. And so those fuels dried out and were available to burn the same year that they grew. At the same time, we had a record drought in California for several years. Fuels are really super dry. There's more fuel than usual on the landscape. And we had these winds, and we always have plenty of ignition. And that gave us this really, you know, combustible situation. And then a lot of homes have been built in these subdivisions that are right up against dense chaparral, so shrubland, fuels, grasses, and things like that as well. That mix of homes and really dense fuels and then the really dry conditions can give you a really risky situation all the way around.
I would ask you, Leroy, to comment on something you had written. You had written that these very destructive wildfires we're seeing are not a natural occurrence, and you link them with climate change. How do we know it's climate change that's feeding this pattern of ever-increasing and more severe fires?
The important thing to keep in mind around the western U.S., well, and globally, is that when we're looking at fire, we're not thinking of fire as a way to prove that climate change is happening. We know climate change is happening because we know about the basic physics of what we're doing to the atmosphere. We know how we change the content of the atmosphere, increasing concentration of greenhouse gases. You know, there would be no life on Earth. Earth would not be warm enough to support the ecosystems that we have without the greenhouse effect. What we've done is intensify that, and so now the temperature of the Earth is catching up, and that's affecting ecosystems. It's that energy imbalance that we've introduced by changing the atmosphere has affected the climate system as a whole, warming up Earth, and there are a lot of feedbacks. And fire is one of those feedbacks. Fire allows us to see some of the impacts very abruptly of climate change on the landscape. So as you warm things up gradually over time, you still get very abrupt changes in the landscape in sort of steps from fire, from insect infestations, and from drought dieback and things like that. So these are natural processes, but they're sort of like a natural way the system responds as it's transformed by climate change.
We have a government in Washington right now, both the Congress and in the White House and the Trump administration, a lot of climate deniers in charge of key agencies that have a lot to do with fighting fires and providing resources to prepare for the next set of fires next season. How is the climate change denial in our government hobbling and placing obstacles for those who are really concerned about it and trying to do their best to combat these fires before they start?
With the current administration, it's hard to see how they are responsive to the science that would tell you what to do, where, and when to get the results that you want to get. So we have a lot of trepidation that policies are going to be enacted to manage the landscape that don't take account of the science that tells us what their effects are going to be. We've had these problems in the past, and if we do it again at this time, this moment in our history, we're just going to be compounding the risks that we face and the difficulty that we're going to have in the future to manage these landscapes in a way that provides the services we want from them.
That was Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California at Merced. For more information on the links between western U.S. wildfires and climate change, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Writer and activist Bill McKibben spoke at Yale University on October 10th, addressing the urgency of taking action to slow down climate chaos. In the wake of many recent disasters predicted by climate scientists, including the deadliest forest fires in California history, and three of the strongest hurricanes ever to hit the U.S. mainland and Caribbean, McKibben talked about the pace of climate change and the people's and politicians' response to it. McKibben wrote The End of Nature in 1988, the first book for non-scientists that explained the concept of climate change. He later co-founded the group 350.org, which has led a global campaign to raise awareness about the impacts of climate change, especially on poor nations and low-lying islands, whose people have contributed the least to create the climate crisis. McKibben now travels the world, raising the alarm about the dire consequences of climate change and urging people to take immediate action to reverse it. During his talk at Yale, he pointed out that although coal plants are being phased out and renewable energy sources are growing by leaps and bounds, the planet is not winning the battle fast enough and hence is losing ground. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus recorded McKibben's Yale speech, titled Simply Too Hot, The Desperate Science and Politics of Climate, and brings us the following excerpts.
There is resistance underway every place around the world now, as I say, and it's beautiful to watch, and it comes from everywhere. So much leadership provided by frontline communities, and especially, I think, most gratifyingly over the last 5 years, by this rapid emergence to the leadership of indigenous traditions around the world. You saw what happened at Standing Rock last autumn, a beautiful, beautiful, powerful gathering. It didn't surprise me because the people who organized it, we've been working with for years, they are great leaders. It's a good sign that the oldest, I was saying this to someone at lunch, that the oldest wisdom tradition on the planet, indigenous wisdom tradition, is meshing now powerfully with the newest, that the word that comes from the sweat lodge and the word that comes from the supercomputer is the same word about what we need to be doing, okay? And now people gather in their numbers. You know, these were 400,000 people on the march in New York City a couple of years ago. Until the Women's March at the beginning of January, the biggest march is about anything in this country in a very long time. And it wasn't just in this country. It was, as usual, all over the entire world. You know, there are sort of tropes that go on in one's, that fit the human mind, our image of, and one of them is the battle of the small against the very large, okay? The David and Goliath story. These are our friends in the Pacific, in those islands like Vanuatu and Tuvalu and the Marshalls and Micronesia and the Solomons that'll probably be underwater by the end of the century. But boy, people, their slogan is, we are not drowning, we are fighting, and boy, they are. While we were marching in New York, they'd cut down on each island a single tree and made a big traditional war canoe, and they took them to Newcastle in the Pacific, which is the biggest coal port in the world. And there they used them for a day to blockade that port and keep the largest ore ships in the world in harbor so they couldn't come out without running them over. It was a brave and beautiful action. It's been one of the reasons that's galvanized Australians into opposing this crazy plan for this giant coal mine. And it illustrated perfectly this trope, the small and the many against the few and the very big. We saw the same image from the Pacific Northwest the next year. This was when Shell Oil announced that they were going to go drill for oil in the Arctic. Okay. Think about that for 1 minute, by the way. Okay. Scientists had said, if you warm the planet, the Arctic will melt. Shell Oil and its ilk paid no attention and went ahead, and what do you know, the Arctic melted. Having looked at that, did the leadership of Shell Oil say, huh, maybe we should go into the solar business instead? This seems not to be working out. No. The leadership of Shell Oil said, hey, it's melted up there now. It will be easier to drill for more oil. In Seattle and in Portland, for days, they blockaded the two giant drilling rigs with small craft. We called them kayaktivists, okay? And it was beautiful. And it threatened brand damage to Shell that was more than they could contend with. And by the end of the year, Shell said, well, we didn't find enough oil in the Arctic, we're going home. Really, what they'd found was far more trouble than they could deal with. And so they turned tail and ran, and that was a very good moment. But we need lots more moments like that. The planet is now way, way outside its comfort zone. That's what it means when the Arctic is melting, when coral is dying. Because it is way, way outside its comfort zone, we need to be outside our comfort zones too. We need to be doing much more than we are doing now, because it is manifest that what we are doing now is insufficient. That's why the temperature keeps going up. All we are asking for is a world a little bit like the one that we were born onto. A little bit of ice at the top and the bottom, the odd coral reef in the middle. That's not a radical demand. That is a conservative demand. Radicals work at all companies. If you get up in the morning willing to make your fortune by altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere, and you are willing to do it after scientists have told you what will happen, and if you're willing to keep doing it after you've seen it happening, then you are a radical in a way we have not had on this planet before, and our job is to check that radicalism. And it is our job... And it is our job to check it fast.
That was Bill McKibben, writer, climate activist, and co-founder of the climate change group 350.org. Learn more about climate change issues, 350.org, and Bill McKibben by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Huey, love for the people. Dr. Huey P. Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, began the organization along with Bobby Seale as a body focused on the people, on their defense, and also in their service. In most media portrayals of the time, black radicals were always described as black militants, and if they were pictured, one saw a young man or woman with a seemingly permanent scowl on their face. Huey broke through this media mold by beginning early with the party's own media. A newsletter made on a mimeograph machine with a picture of a young black man killed by cops in Richmond, California. I have to ask, does anybody in this audience know what a mimeograph machine even is? If you do, I bet you're over 50. What was the point, though? That the people were important, not the party. For party members were taught from the first days of membership that party members were servants of the people. It is in that spirit that we saw party leaders start programs like the Free Breakfast for Children program, the Free Clothing program, Free Shoes programs, and free health clinic programs and the like. Those programs, based in local churches or party offices, serve to develop close relationships between the people and the party in a way that has rarely been imitated by radical or revolutionary collectives. On November 18, 1970, Huey gave a speech at Boston College. There, he spoke about many of these programs that the party began, telling the audience, "In order to exist, we must survive. Therefore, we need a survival kit, the 10-point program. It is necessary for our children to grow up healthy, with functional and creative minds. They cannot do this if they do not get the correct nutrition. That is why we have a breakfast program for children. We also have community health programs. We have a busing program. We call it the bus for relatives and parents of prisoners. We realize that the fascist regime that operates the prisons throughout America would like to do their treachery in the dark. But if we get the relatives, parents, and friends to the prisons, they can expose the treachery of the fascists." Dr. Huey P. Newton ended his speech by telling the audience that the people make the revolution. What we see here is that the central governing ethos of the party was a survival and well-being of the people. What people? The most oppressed segment of American society, black people, poor people. It is from this community that the party drew its members. It is to this community that the party directed its 10-point program. It is for this community that the survival programs were implemented. Whether we use the term the community or the people, we're talking about the same entity. The Black Panther Party went through a number of ideological iterations, from nationalists to internationalists, from Malcolmites to Marxists, from Marxists to intercommunalists. But the party performed another vital service, one rarely given credit for, and that's in the realm of theory. Dr. Huey P. Newton dared to theorize and analyze the world around him and to call that theory intercommunalism. What did he mean by intercommunalism? Dr. Newton argued that the party and all phenomena goes through a period and process of transformation based upon the notion of dialectical materialism, and he illustrated this by the initial phase of the party being nationalist to internationalist and beyond. He argued further that the power of the U.S. empire was such that it neutralized and actually negated other nations. Dr. Newton wrote, "We found that because everything is in a constant state of transformation, because of the development of the mass media, because of the firepower of the imperialists, and because of the fact that the United States is no longer a nation but an empire, nations could not exist. for they did not have the criteria for nationhood. Their self-determination, economic determination, and cultural determination has been transformed by the imperialists and the ruling circle. They were no longer nations. We found that in order to be internationalist, we had to also be nationalist, or at least acknowledge nationhood. Internationalism, if I understand the word, means the interrelationship among a group of nations. But since no nation exists, and since the United States is in fact an empire, it's impossible for us to be internationalists. These transformations and phenomena require us to call ourselves intercommunalists, because nations have been transformed into communities of the world. That's the words and ideas of Dr. Huey P. Newton. The value of any theory is not a question about the theorist, but how clearly it tracks and predicts reality. In 1972, Huey wrote The Technology Question, which all but predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. Dr. Newton critiqued the late Soviet policy of peaceful coexistence, which Newton blamed on an incorrect analysis of the very nature of the imperialists. Huey characterized this idea as a blow to the many countries opposing the empire, such as Vietnam. Dr. Newton reasoned that this policy was, in fact, an admission of Soviet weakness, which damaged resistance movements in the so-called Third World. His conclusion is a biting one. He wrote, "With the high quality of Soviet development at a time when the United States was less advanced than it is today, the Russians could have built up the necessary force to oppose imperialism. Now, all they can do is whimper like whipped dogs and talk about peaceful coexistence so that they will not be destroyed." This presents the world with the hard fact that the United States is the only state power in the world. Russia has become, like all other nations, no more than a satellite of the United States. American rulers do not care about how much Russians say that they are the Soviets, as long as Ford can build its motor company in their territory. In late 1991, less than 20 years after Huey wrote these words, the Soviet Union essentially abolished itself, and Russia began the long trek to crony capitalism. Dr. Huey P. Newton, known to history as one of the principal founders of the Black Panther Party, but also one hell of a political theorist. Thank you for your time. On the move from imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Is Kurdish nationalism a deliberately weaponized instrument of U.S. imperial policy in Syria? In what ways is the plight of the Kurds in northeastern Syria being distorted? Why are revered human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Médecins Sans Frontières aligning with imperial interests in Syria? Who are the Syrians in Canada promoting regime change in their home country? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we deconstruct the various propaganda elements sustaining Western popular support for the U.S.-NATO military interventions in the country. We'll hear Syrian-American political commentator and Mint Press News contributor Sarah Abed debunk the heroic narratives surrounding the Kurdish resistance and their nationalistic ambitions. We'll hear investigative reporter and book author Mark Taliano correct the record on the myth of Assad's war crimes in Syria. And we'll hear a Syrian-Canadian academic, Majd Zouda, discuss the dynamics within the Syrian diaspora that enable the continued propaganda narratives against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. On this week's program, The War on Syria, Debunking Progressive Left Narratives. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 27th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In the case of OxyContin, the pills are legal, while heroin is considered a Class A illegal drug. However, heroin and OxyContin are both opiates or derivatives of opium, which in its unprocessed form is, of course, illegal. Purdue Pharma, which is privately owned by the Sackler family, according to Keefe, has made billions of dollars off of OxyContin. Until recently, Purdue Pharma enlisted its hundreds of sales representatives to convince doctors that OxyContin was not addictive. It also sent physicians who advocated for OxyContin on lavish trips to speak at medical conferences where they would praise the drug and employed other strategies to try and ensure the continued maximum prescribing of the drug. That comes from the article, Pharmaceutical Firm Makes Billions by Fueling Opioid Crisis, by Mark Carlin, posted October 26th. Chemical-intensive green revolution technology and ideology has effectively uprooted indigenous traditional agriculture across the planet and has recast farming according to the needs of global agribusiness and its supply chains. This has had devastating effects on regions, rural communities, diets, soils, health, and water pollution. However, this financially lucrative venture for transnational corporations continues apace, spearheaded by the Gates Foundation in Africa and the World Bank's Enabling the Business of Agriculture. This model of agriculture is poisoning life and the environment and undermining food security throughout the globe. Power is now increasingly concentrated in the hands of a handful of transnational agribusiness corporations, which put profit and market control ahead of food security, health and nutrition, and biodiversity. That comes from the article, Food, Agriculture, and the Global Ecology, Rolling Back the Tide of Pesticide Poison, Corruption, and Looming Mass Extinction, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted October 24th. People getting mass health assume they are getting health insurance. In fact, if they are over 55, they are only getting a loan for health coverage, which they must pay back from their estate, their home, their savings, their personal property, after they die. The process by which the state recovers the cost of your health care coverage is called estate recovery. The low-income people whom MassHealth is supposed to serve may thus be unable to leave the one thing they might have, their family home, to their children. MassHealth does not tell you exactly what health coverage they will be charging your estate for after you die. One must assume it is any and all health care provided. That comes from the article, Medicaid is a Scam, Estate Recovery in Massachusetts, by Richard Hugus, posted October 23rd, originally appearing at richardhugus.wordpress.com. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The realities behind the conflict in Syria may have been concealed behind a propaganda curtain generated in the West. Earlier interviews with Ava Bartlett and Vanessa Bealey have exposed the fact that people on the ground have a much different message about their plight that is being actively negated by mainstream news sources. In this program, we're attempting to carry on that conversation. Sarah Abbott is a Syrian-American independent investigative political commentator who focuses on exposing the lies and propaganda in mainstream media news and social media. She is a truth advocate who uses her social media accounts and website, The Rabbit Hole, at www.sarahabbott.com to counter Western media disinformation about Syria. Sarah Abbott, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Now, The Kurds have gotten a heroic reputation in recent years as a major force of resistance against ISIS-Daesh. How exactly do you see these Kurds aligning with U.S. imperial interests in Syria?
Okay, well, the first aspect I just want to touch on is that historically they have been used in uprisings for the same exact reason. So this isn't the first time that they've been used as pawns or as a tool to destabilize the area or for imperialism. Back in 1965 to 1975, actually, Israel had supported them when they had an uprising against the Iraqis. And the U.S. actually supported them as well, but then they backed out when Iran and Iraq came to an agreement. And they had ended their war. And there were a number of Kurds that actually got massacred as a result of that. So it's kind of interesting that the Kurds are now finding themselves in the same position as they were before. And they're not realizing that the U.S. intends to only use them, you know, to carry out their mission. But then after that, their support kind of is no longer there. So, the U.S. is not really interested in, you know, them establishing autonomy or an independent Kurdistan, because if they do that, then they won't be able to use them again to destabilize the area and to benefit Israel. And if we were to look at the Oded Inan plan for Greater Israel, it actually states in there that it's imperative that they're going to be using the Kurds to help divide the neighboring countries. Now, the Kurds have also, in Turkey, back in 1914 to 1923, they were committing genocide against Christian minority groups, including the Assyrians, the Armenians. And then a lot of those Assyrians and Armenians, when they fled Turkey, they went to Syria and they established the city called El Kamishli, which now, interestingly enough, the Syrian Kurds are saying that that's now the capital of their Rojava or Hova, you know. So they have been in this position before. This is not a unique position for them to be in, but the surprising part is that they keep, you know, allowing themselves to be used in this way with hopes that, you know, that they're going to get their independent Kurdistan. But for anyone that's looked at the history, they've seen that, you know, that's not really something that the U.S. or Israel or, you know, their allies really want them to have. Now, with Israel, they benefit from them, and they've had a really long relationship together. I mean, for the past 50 years or so, Israel has been training some of their top security officials and, you know, mentoring them and such. And these relationships kind of just surfaced, the information about them surfaced just recently. But so they've had a long relationship there. Mm. So, they're finding themselves in the same position that they were multiple times before.
Okay. Now, can you address the portrayals we've seen from the Kurdish advocates as they're gender egalitarian and democratic and inclusive? That seems to be – and also they have a longstanding reputation as a persecuted minority. I'm wondering if you might have any comments about those portrayals.
Absolutely. The media has portrayed them in such a positive way. They've romanticized them. They've basically made them out to be these, wonderful warriors against Daesh, and that they're the best. They refer to them as, the best fighters against Daesh. And that whole image is PR. It's just public relations. It's just to garner support for the U.S. to support them. Now, what the U.S. did was in October of 2015, they established the Syrian Democratic Forces. Okay, and what that basically was is they took the YPG, who is the military branch of the PYD, which is the Kurdish group in Syria. And they basically told them, we're going to need you to rebrand yourself. We're going to need you to come up with a new name, because your name right now is associated with the PKK, which is a known terrorist group by the U.S. and Turkey. And the PKK is located, they're located in Turkey. So the YPG came up with, this new name, Syrian Democratic Forces. And it's almost comical because in a July interview with a U.S. commander, he was asked, or actually I think it was the April interview, he was asked, what percentage are Arabs in the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces? And he said 20%. So that's an indication right there that, what they're trying to portray is that this is a group that, is made up of Syrians and, even some Christian minorities and Kurds, and that they're all there just to fight, Daesh. But the majority of them are Kurds, okay, and they have their ties to the PKK. So they're no different than the PKK. They're just the Syrian offshoot. Now, as far as persecution and, what they claim, I mean, it's kind of interesting that they keep saying these different things, that they've been mistreated and such, while at the same time, they're actually mistreating Syrians and Christian minorities in Syria, okay? They've been carrying out these ethnic cleansing missions, basically in Raqqa and in other areas. And the sole mission of that is to change the demographics so that in these areas that were predominantly, Arab or Christian, now that they've been driven out of their homes and their homes have been confiscated, the Kurds move in and they now say, okay, now we're the majority, so we're going to take this land, this area, we've liberated it, it's now part of ours, and they're going to try to use that as a bargaining tool. So the Kurds, I mean, we just have to keep in mind that in Syria, they're only 7 to 10% of the whole population. And in the Northeast, they're only about 30 to 40% of the population. Yet, they want to claim that area, okay, and that's the most agriculturally rich and oil-rich area, which supports the rest of the country. So other Syrians are supposed to be supported by that as well, but they want to just claim that to be, part of their own area. They originally had come from, they came in waves around the 1920s, and then multiple times afterwards from Turkey, where they were being, you know, persecuted there, or, you know, they had some issues there. Now, the Syrian government, their main mission is they just want unity. They want the country to be for all Syrians, whereas the Kurds, you know, the separatist Kurds, I just want to make sure that everyone understands that whenever we say Kurds, we're not talking about the entire ethnicity. They're not one monolithic group. They are there are 30 million people who have, you know, they speak different languages, they have different religions, they have different political views. Some identify as being, you know, Kurdish. Others identify as being Iraqi or Syrian or Iranian or Turkish, first and foremost, okay? So they're not one group that we can kind of lump in together. But as far as the separatist group, the separatist Kurds, you know, they've been, in addition to driving out Arabs and Christians from their homes, they're forcing the young men and some young women to join the SDF. And they're also enforcing their Kurdish curriculum on schools. And there's a number of schools that have been closed, and the principals and teachers have been locked up because they wouldn't teach, you know, the Kurdish curriculum. They're also enforcing all these different taxes and rules. And their police division, they're called the Eshaish, they've been harassing non-Kurds. And a really important point that, you know, I've made before, and I want to make again here on your show, is that they've actually also worked, or, you know, with Daesh and other terrorist groups. I mean, so that kind of alone, I would think, negates the whole idea of them being these revolutionary, upright, you know.
How have they worked with Daesh?
You know. Well, in certain parts, what they've done is, I guess they've given them notice that they're going to be coming into that area, and then Daesh just surrender, and then they join their forces. So they just surrender and they join their forces. They've actually done this in Iraq. They've done it in Syria in multiple places. And, you know, what's alarming is you would think that they would put up a fight, but even some of the Daesh members and, you know, who have defected, they've said that we were told not to kill the SDF. We were told, you know, to surrender to them. You know, in Iraq, they were told to surrender to them, the Peshmerga, rather than the Iraqi government, the Iraqi armed forces. And in Syria, we're seeing them also, you know, basically either leaving the area, and also actually at one point, the Kurds we saw, and this was a video that was taken by, I think, RT or one of the Russian media outlets. It was a video of an entire, like, a whole convoy of trucks that were filled with Daesh members that were just passing through while, you know, an SDF area. And SDF just, you know, the Kurds, they just let them pass through. So they've definitely worked together. And also with the Free Syrian Army and other terrorist groups. So, you know, you can't really say that you're fighting them, but you're also working with them. This is all, again, this all goes into the whole PR thing. You know, their PR image, their media image is a lot different than what's happening on the ground. And that's where I get my information, is on the ground from Syrians and from actually even Kurds that are against what they're seeing, you know, other Kurds doing. And they're speaking up too, but they're being told not to, and they've been silenced a number of times. So now, you know, that's something that we're seeing, is that the image that they're portraying is different. I mean, on TV, I think I've seen a couple of, like, little clips and such and advertisements where they had, like, the women, okay, and they were saying that, you know, these are Kurdish female fighters. Well, the Syrian army has female fighters. They have a female division. The Syriac Sotoro in the northeast, okay, they're Orthodox Christian. They have their own women's division as well. So there's different, but you're not going to see those. You're only going to see the Peshmerga and the YPG, you know, women soldiers. What they don't want you to see, however, is what's going on with Turkey, with the PKK, and actually even with the YPG, where they are actually kidnapping you know, Kurdish children and turning them into child soldiers and, you know, or forcing them to fight with them. And that those are some things that you don't see. Also recently in Syria, they've been putting up like flags of Öcalan, who is the leader of the PKK. So they're not even trying to hide right now the association between the YPG and the PKK. And again, the PKK, we know, is a terrorist. They're considered a terrorist organization.
Mm.
So
how, I just wanted to ask, you know, how would you describe Kurdish allegiance with the U.S., you know, in light of what you were saying earlier? I mean, is this a one of genuine solidarity, or is it a maybe a cynical and temporary alliance of convenience?
I think from the U.S. side, it's solely, you know, for them to carry out a mission for the U.S., okay, to destabilize the area or to create, you know, and because they have a number of bases now in Syria as well, like a number of them in the northeast, and I think there's a couple in the south as well. So the U.S., they see them as, you know what, we're able to stay in this area in Syria as long as we have the, you know, the YPG in control of the area. And now we have eyes and ears on Iran, okay, and we can protect Israel. So for them, it's just, what can they get out of the deal? I mean, on both sides, it's basically that, you know. But now with the Kurds, what they're thinking, I think, is that, okay, since the U.S. is arming us and funding us and training us and, you know, really helping us out, they must support our independence or at least our demands for autonomy or for us to control these oil-rich, agriculturally-rich areas. And, you know, we're going to have to see how that plays out. But if it's anything like what has historically happened, then we're going to see that the U.S. is going to pull out whenever the Kurds have fulfilled their mission. So we're going to have to see how that goes. Now, the Syrian government, they've even said that once Daesh is defeated, they're willing to sit down with the Kurds and come to some sort of an agreement. But it has to be within the parameters of the Syrian constitution. They're not going to be able to give them an autonomous area, probably not even a federation, but they're going to try to come to some sort of an agreement with them. And at the same time, President Assad did say that he wanted to, you know, liberate every inch of Syria. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. Now, as far as in Iraq, we saw with the September 25th, the Barzani Kurdish referendum, which was universally opposed. And that was led by the KRG. Now, what we saw there was, I think the Kurds had expected that the U.S. would kind of go in and back them up and be there for them. And when they saw that, you know, Trump was saying, we're not taking a side, even though they were pretty much arming both sides, they have armed both sides. But when they said they're not going to take a side, a lot of, you know, Kurds did get upset. And there were demonstrations where they were, you know, hurling a lot of different anti-American sentiments. And they were saying things like death for America. And what's important to, and this is when Kirkuk was basically taken back by the Iraqi armed forces. And it was in a disputed area. So it never, it didn't belong, so to speak, to the Kurds. But it was theirs temporarily because they had liberated it from Daesh a couple of years ago. But now when they took it back, the Kurds did get a little upset. But the crazy thing is that before they had this referendum, they actually had more freedom. After the referendum, you know, their airports were shut down. I believe the banking system, the media, everything was now.
Yeah,
the Iraqi government was trying to now control it because, you know, and they had a semi-autonomous region. So they were trying to go from semi-autonomous to, you know, fully autonomous and not going through, you know, the Iraqi constitution. But they did come out yesterday and say that they want to do a ceasefire. They want to freeze the results of the referendum and that they are now open to dialogue based on the Iraqi constitution. So that's good. And Israel was really upset about them losing Kirkuk because of the oil, the very oil-rich area. So, So, I mean, basically, the main point, though, is that this whole idea of Kurdish independence, and this kind of goes back to what you're asking about the PR, it's a very ethnocentric, chauvinistic idea, okay? Something like this would be considered in the U.S. to be racist or, it would be frowned upon. Yet a lot of Americans somehow feel that, they feel sympathy and they feel like, these are a prosecuted people and they deserve to have their own land. The land that they're claiming, they never owned it. They don't have any legitimate or legal or historical, ties to this land. They have migrated. They're nomadic. They really do not like for that word to be used. But even if you look at what the word Kurd means, it basically does mean nomad. And they refer to, I think it was about 200 different tribes, okay, that came out of Iran. They refer to all of those as Kurds. So anyone that was a nomadic group, that's what their name was. So now, for them to now say that, okay, we want to establish this whole region, this whole country, okay, for ourselves, which takes a part of four different countries, okay, you got Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. They want to take a portion of these four countries and establish their own country. What about the people that live in those areas? In northeast Syria, for instance, the Syrians, the Assyrians, the Armenians, all these different minority groups, and the Arabs, why are they now going to be treated as second-class citizens in that country so that one group could get autonomy or, get their independence? Other groups are now going to suffer. And a very interesting thing that I've noticed is, especially with anarchists, is that they're very much against the idea of big states. They prefer little statelets or no borders, right? Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Kurdistan and Kurds, they're for, they are supporting their idea of establishing their own state. So how are they against Syria, okay, being its own sovereign country? They're against, they don't see a problem with Syria being broken up into smaller statelets, okay? And at the same time, they want to see Kurdistan establish their own country. So it's a contradiction, and it makes absolutely no sense. And they're basically putting all the facts, a lot of things that I've mentioned, to you right now, they're putting all those on the side and saying, no, you know what? These people need their own land. They're not monolithic, okay? They have different languages. They have different sects of religion. So they're not one united group that all want the same thing. And that's the main thing that I think a lot of people need to understand.
Okay.
And they've also, done quite a bit of persecution and such, which they're claiming was done against them, but they've done it as well. So,
Well, I think we're going to have to close it there, but I want to really thank you for sharing your perspectives with us. And just
you're very welcome.
And I'll just remind our listeners that you can find Sarah Abed's articles on her site, www.sarahabed.com. Sarah Abed is a Syrian-American independent investigative political commentator, and you can also find more of her articles on globalresearch.ca. Thanks again, Sarah Abed.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me. Take care.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Well, we are joined through Skype by Mark Taliano, and we're going to be speaking about Syria, and in particular his book Voices from Syria, which has just come out this year. Mark Taliano is a former high school teacher
an author and an independent investigative reporter, as well as a research associate with the Center for Research on Globalization. In September of 2016, Mark traveled to Syria, and where he was able to corroborate some of his own research into the Syrian conflict and the distortions of reality presented in mainstream and some alternative media discourse. And so Mark Taliano is joining us from Hamilton. So welcome, Mark Taliano.
Hi, Michael. Nice to be with you. I've seen some of your shows. I really enjoy them.
Just to start, when you started to question the official account of Syria and what's been going on there, can I ask, you know, maybe where you started to have doubts about the official story, maybe what your sources of information were?
Well, I'd read a lot of Michel Chassudowski's book, but certainly people should have remembered all the lies as fake pretext to the war on Iraq. And so it seemed quite clear that the same thing was going on in Syria. And I think that people would see it as clearly as that if they would turn off the television and not read the newspapers, which is asking a lot.
Mark, could I ask you to maybe share a particular anecdote? I mean, you were there in September.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there's something that could really impress on our listeners just the extent of the ordeal that they endured.
Every story that's in the book is really horrible. Lily Martin is and then the other thing here is, Lily Martin, for example, who's in my book, and I use some of her testimonies, and I always corroborate all the testimonies. She's a permanent resident in Syria, but she's also an American citizen. And so the U.S. empire has citizens living in Syria who have to withstand this. And so this comes from Lily Martin, permanent resident in Syria, who happens to also be an American citizen. And this is what happened. She writes about why she could not vote for Hillary Clinton. And this is what she said. She personally oversaw the transfer of weapons from Libya to Turkey to be used specifically by the American-backed terrorists who destroyed my own home on March 21st, 2014 and beheaded my Christian neighbors and raped the old ladies who they kidnapped and took to Turkey and killed others and destroyed the whole village of Kassab, Syria. This is not a rumor. This is a fact. Lily writes, this is well documented in her time as Secretary of State. So what Lily, I mean, it's disgusting, but every single story that I heard is disgusting. That's the story. I mean, that's just one of many, many, many stories that these people have to, of life that these people have to endure thanks to us, thanks to the West, thanks to the NATO terrorists. And what Lily is referring to there is the weapons rat line from Libya. Early in the war, the weapons rat line that came from Libya's looted armories all the way to Syria. And some people think that that's part of the reason why Libya was destroyed. And it probably was. That's one of many reasons, and every reason was a bad reason.
I know that Aleppo had been occupied for some time by the al-Nusra and ISIS forces, and a lot of people were forced, basically kidnapped, and not allowed to escape. Did you hear any reports from out of there?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, in Aleppo was liberated, and then all sorts of evidence came out that confirmed what documentation has confirmed, which is all these terrorists, they're just one and the same. They're all Al-Qaeda affiliates. They're all linked to Al-Qaeda, including ISIS. And for example, you had the FSA, you had Daesh, you had all sorts of different groups coming together in a part of Aleppo that they occupied, and they worked together. and they hoarded medicine that was, you know, given to them from our government, and they hoarded food, and they launched ordnance filled with explosives and nails and poison gas regularly, all the time, into the parts of Aleppo that were not occupied. And when people tried to leave through these corridors, which the terrorists mined, they were shot. So people couldn't leave. They were totally captive. And all sorts of coercive methods were used to have these people trained basically as slaves. Do what we say or we kill you, literally. And the terrorists, as policy, they use hospitals, they occupy hospitals, and they, because those, typically because they're very solid buildings, but also they're protected. And we've seen all the public relations about that. But they occupy hospitals, they get their medicines there, and they create jail cells in the hospital building, and they put victims in the jail cells, and they torture them there. And they execute people. And they have sniper posts perched on the top of the hospitals often. So these hospitals are used as command posts, as torture centers, Sharia law courts. That's where they hoard food and medicine. That's often the base from which these terrorists operate. And the rest of the Aleppo population is captive. Yeah. Like the occupied parts of say East Aleppo, the occupied parts where the terrorists, they didn't occupy all of Aleppo, they weren't able to do so, but the parts that they did occupy, the people didn't want them there, and the people were captive. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't hear these stories, and all these stories are corroborated by numerous sources.
Amnesty International,
Médecins
Sans Frontières,
Avaz
have been very, very on top of that anti-Assad campaign. I was wondering if you could try to account for people who hold those entities in such high esteem. I mean, how do you explain to them these accounts are inaccurate, and how do you make sense of that?
This is the new way that empire works. They corrupt agencies. Now, none of these so-called non-governmental agencies are non-governmental. They're all governmental. They're funded by the government and foundations. And there's a revolving door often between the board of directors and the State Department. For example, Susan Nossel was with the U.S. government, and then she transferred over to Amnesty International. So all these and all these groups, they are an appendage of empire because they are embedded with the terrorists, and that includes the White Helmets. The White Helmets are actually Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And that's hard for a lot of people to swallow, especially since the White Helmets won an Oscar. Vanessa Billy's done a wonderful work for this. So what we have here is this whole complex of non-governmental agencies, Amnesty International, Avaz. They're all governmental. They're all embedded with the terrorists. And they're supported by foundation money as well. And they are the source for our mainstream media stories.
I'm really astonished by the extent to which the left and the anti-war movement has been corrupted. I mean, I know that, I mean, astonishingly enough, like you, at the outset, you talked about Iraq, and my sense was that there was broad opposition to the Iraq war. And this is only 2 years or less than 2 years after 9/11. And now there's hardly any anti-war campaign against Syria in sight. So it's really quite remarkable. I mean, is there anything more you could say about this, extent to which the success of the this interference, this confusion within Syria yeah. solidarity circles.
It is really astonishing because, as you said, Iraq, there were huge protests. I think this is unprecedented. The amount of lies about the war on Syria, I think, is basically unprecedented. Prof. Tim Anderson would agree. He wrote a book on it as well. I think we have to address these taboo topics, including 9/11. Because after 9/11, this war on terror, which is a war for terror, literally, all of these invasions have accelerated. Afghanistan didn't attack us, and Afghanistan was attacked. I mean, none of these countries attacked us. Now the truth is coming out, but it's been coming out for 7 years. But now that liberated areas are, you know, now that the devastation is there and some of us are on the ground, Vanessa Bealey, Eva Bartlett, Tim Anderson, Janice Kortkamp, I was there and I hope to go back. We're taking pictures. There's people on the ground right now. Janice is there. Tim is there. And they see these huge arsenals of weaponry, all NATO weaponry that ISIS and the other terrorists left behind in their rush to leave. So the evidence, primary source evidence, is overwhelming.
A couple of familiar talking points that's adding to the confusion on the anti-imperialist left. For one thing, yeah. as you recall, Maher Arar was sent to rendition to Syria, where he was tortured. So that's one thing that a lot of activists are mindful of. There is also this idea of the Arab Spring and the Dara in Dara, where there was this major uprising and yeah. Apparently or supposedly the Syrian armed forces attacked peaceful protesters. So I'm wondering if, just before we kind of close this discussion, if you'd like to address those two.
Yeah, well, it was an intelligence operation from the beginning. It's similar to these. So what happened in Dara is, as I mentioned earlier, the weapons were already there. They had weapons. It's an intelligence operation. And people were protesting in Syria, as they do in other countries, peacefully. There were polls done from both sides, and they didn't want violence. The people did not want violence. But as was the case with Ukraine, and as was the case with other so-called uprisings, militants were inserted into it, and they would provoke violence, and they would shoot at police. And the police, people won't believe this, but the police were ordered to not carry arms. Okay, they were, and the police were being slaughtered. And this is well documented in the book. So we have outsiders coming in, instigating violence to create a fake revolution.
Could you address the point about Maher Arar and thought, feelings, how that colors people's thinking about Assad?
Well, okay, so the empire tortures people all over the world, but they like to work, CIA likes to work beneath the mantle of plausible deniability. So they would often outsource the torture. So this ties in with the Arar story, where the torture is outsourced. Now bear in mind that the empire can be very, very coercive. If a country such as Syria stands up to the empire and says, no, we don't want this, no, we resist your overtures, no, we do not want ISIS, Al-Qaeda to govern us, the empire can be very, very coercive. They have a whole raft of, they have these mercenaries, and they destroy countries that stand up to empire. They destroy Libya, Iraq, Ukraine, and so on and so forth. So if the empire demands, well, guess what? I want you to torture so-and-so, that can be pretty coercive.
Okay. Well, Mark, I think we got to leave it there, but I just want to remind folks again that the book is Voices from Syria, just published earlier this year. You can purchase it from the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. Thank you again for agreeing to this interview.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be speaking with you.
His name is Mark Taliano, and he is a author and independent investigative reporter. He joined us from Hamilton, Ontario. In Canada, speakers and activists who have attempted to challenge mainstream narratives of a Syrian civil war between a moderate, pro-democracy opposition and a brutal Assad regime have encountered significant opposition even from within left progressive circles, and critical pro-interventionist Syrian Canadians are playing a role. To give us more details about the obstacles plaguing the Syrian solidarity movement, we're joined from Toronto by Majd Zouda. She is a PhD candidate in science education at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at the University of Toronto. She was born in Kuwait but moved to Damascus in 2005, where she lived until 2012 before moving to Canada. She still has family in Damascus that she visits annually. So, Majd Zouda, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's my pleasure.
Now, could you maybe talk about some of the... I'll just give you a little bit of my background. I had actually helped to organize a visit by Ava Bartlett and in Winnipeg in February, and I put the message out. I contacted an Islamic group that I know and just had them put the word out, and I guess within about like 48 hours I got 5 emails saying that this was very disrespectful and that I should cancel the event. So I'm not used to that. Okay, I mean, I've encountered resistance to activism before, but nothing like that. Do you have any? And they claim to be of the Syrian diaspora. Do you have any insights into who these people are that are from the anti-Assad, pro-interventionist Syrians?
Okay. Thank you for that, Michael. I would like to say one thing here about this resistance, which we faced it from Syrians who are claiming that they are opposing President Assad because he's a dictator and because they wanted freedom for the Syrian people. And yet, if you dare to say anything that doesn't agree in any way in whatever they're claiming, they will immediately point their finger aggressively and they will accuse you of being supporting dictator, brutal, or whatever it is, and they will try to stop you from saying your perspective in all possible ways, which I found it like very strange for people who are actually claiming that they are supporting freedom and at the same time they suppress other people's opinion. How can I describe that? I think we contend that there are opposition from wide varieties, but for those specifically that they are becoming more aggressive, we find that a lot of people who are from the fundamentalist perspective are very active in that direction. And even when I was living in Syria in the beginning of the very, very beginning of the war, some of the groups that went out claiming that or like opposing President Assad and the Syrian government, their main motive was like to kick out the Christian out of the country and also to send Alawite to the grave. So from the very beginning, their motives were very sectarian. They don't accept other people's opinions. They have their own view that they want to impose on the Syrian people, which is very secular and very diverse. And I believe a lot of those people came here, especially probably from Muslim Brotherhood. They came here as refugees, even before the Syrian war started in 2011. And because they were in, they had a lot of troubles in Syria. They committed violent events in Syria during the 70s, late 70s, beginning of the 80s. And because the Syrian government was taking a strict procedure against them, many of them probably asked for to be refugees in different parts of the world, and I think there's a big part of them here in Canada, and probably they could be one of the group that they are trying to resist and to stop your work.
So there's a large number of people who came here as refugees who are these fundamentalists and Muslim Brotherhood. I don't know if there's much distinction between the two. But I mean, were they coming in different streams, or were they? I mean, were they all? Was there just a large influx of people? And you have the secular people, we say more like yourself, mixed in with these individuals.
You mean the who came in refugees after the 2011 or before that?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of the people who have been most vocal in recent years. I mean, have they been here for many years, or did they just come in here over the last maybe 7-8 years or so?
I think some of them have been here like a long time, and they have a strong opposition on few since long time, like even before 2011. And probably they have participated in a way in what's happening in Syria or by supporting fundamentalist groups in Syria. But I think also, I believe, and this is my perspective, again, I cannot, from what I saw, I believe that a lot of them came during the refugee, but not all of them. Like, there are a lot of refugees who are, secular. There are some refugees who came after 2011 who are really suffering, because they are really suffering from the war that's happened in Syria. I'm not here as a refugee. I came as an immigrant skilled worker. So there are the refugees who are coming here after 2011. There are wide spectrum, but I think that there are big part of them with a fundamentalist view.
Could you comment?
This is my impression, because most of the people came from camps in Jordan and in Lebanon and in Turkey. And we know that a lot of people who went to the camps are from the opposition with the fundamentalist views. Again, not all of them, definitely not all of them. And some of them were just running away of the war and the conflict that's happening there. But we also, as a person who lived in Syria and had family in Syria, I have the impression that a lot of people in the camp come with a fundamentalist view.
Interesting. Now, you're based in Toronto. Can you comment? I just shared a little bit of the story from Winnipeg vantage point. Could you share any stories things that you've experienced in Toronto in terms of disruption and whatnot?
I haven't encountered personally one of those. I remember when we tried to attend Eva Bartlett's event here in Toronto. She said the story about tried to be sabotaged and they couldn't book a place to have the event. They found difficulties in doing that. This is one incident that I heard about. The other thing which I noticed that in the media and in the event, for example, many film festivals that happen in Toronto, it's not only one perspective of the Syrian conflict that is usually presented, which is that the Syrian government and President Assad is a brutal dictator, which is not the truth at all. And there is no representation to any other perspective of whatever happened in Syria. And even if you try to reach to the media, and I think one of our colleagues, Lulwa, was trying to reach the media and to talk to them and try to have an interview where she can speak her mind and tell about the other perspective of what's happening in Syria. But unfortunately, she couldn't have any access to that.
Hmm. Another thing that I experienced was I'd reached out to some of the progressive left groups that I'm acquainted with, and I was rather shocked by the resistance that I encountered. And the few groups that did show support for the Eva Bartlett event, they didn't want to be publicly acknowledged. Does that sound familiar to you in terms of trying to relate to the anti-war anti-imperialist left?
I mean, I won't say that. How can I say? I think it's a problem about, like, the problem that I mentioned about, like, you cannot say any, like, it seems that you cannot say any opposite opinion or to express it loudly, because you will be accused in, immediately, and fingers will be pointed at you. I was in one event when I was, like, it was an anti-Assad event, and I was trying to say that this is not what's happening. And I remember the two couple, and like, what are you saying? Are you defending Assad? And they said, yes, he's not like that. And they immediately, like, look at me as if I'm a murderer or a monster, and they went, like, move away. And I think this is one main issue when you cannot, like, express, the, like, how would you know the truth if you cannot, or, like, know what's going there if you cannot hear from all different perspectives?
Hmm. I'm wondering if maybe just in closing, you can talk a little bit about how you see the anti-Assad Syrians and other individuals, how they are continuing to sabotage any conversation, any possibility of unity among the Syrian people.
I mean, like, just recently we had, I don't know if you knew about our national football team was playing to get to the World Cup. And in the team, there are players who are pro-Syrian government and pro-President Assad. And we know that there are, like, some people who were against the Syrian government and against President Assad. And they were called into to play in the national team. And it seems that unite, like, this made a unity between a lot of Syrian people who were, like, divided. But still, there were people, especially with fundamentalist perspective, who were, like, very angry about what happened, and they tried to advertise that. They tried to advertise it as in a negative way. So even anyway, like, in any way that can bring the Syrian people together and, like, make any possibilities for conversation, for celebrating, it's been perceived as a negative event, and it's tried to be stop anyway. Not stop, like, either advertise in a negative way or in some cases sabotage.
Hmm. Well, Maj Zuda, I really want to thank you for sharing your insights, and thank you for coming on and speaking your truth. It's seems to be rare, a rare perspective, unfortunately, in the media these days. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate that you give us, again, the possibility to say something other than you hear in the mainstream media, and to just give some insight about what's going there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
We've been joined by Maj Zuda. She is a Toronto-based PhD candidate in science education at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at the University of Toronto, and she is a member of the Syrian diaspora in Canada.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.